Case number 22-5277, N Citizens United PAC Appellant versus Federal Election Commission, a New Republican PAC. Mr. Hancock for the appellant, Ms. Ward for the appellee, Ms. Murphy for the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Hancock, please proceed when you're ready, please.
I would respectfully like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Kevin Hancock for the appellant and Citizens United PAC. This case involves two recent divided panel rulings that call out for correction because they have granted the Federal Election Commission the power to shield its legal decisions from judicial review and to nullify the Federal Election Campaign Act's private right of action. The Supreme Court and this court have long recognized that FECA's unique judicial review provision rebuts Heckler v. Cheney's presumption of non-reviewability. Indeed, review under FECA does not implicate the FEC's prosecutorial discretion at all, since such review can never require the FEC to go forward and enforce the law. Instead, review serves the purposes of correcting legal error and potentially unlocking the Act's private right of action. The Crewe cases, however, departed from these precedents by holding that as few as just one of the FEC's six commissioners can block review and block the private right of action simply by asserting prosecutorial discretion was a reason why they voted that a particular complaint lacks merit. For at least three independent reasons, that holding is incorrect, and we respectfully ask that the Crewe cases be overturned. Your Honor, the first reason why the Crewe cases holding was incorrect is because of the particular point at which review was occurring at the dismissal that's at issue here. So FECA creates a complaint-driven adjudicatory process that does not resemble the decision of a lone prosecutor deciding whether or not to indict. Complaint-driven process that has along the path to potentially the FEC filing suit two merits checkpoints. They are called reason to believe and probable cause to believe. Those two merits checkpoints are akin to a court deciding a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment. The Act states that if the commission finds reason to believe, it shall investigate. It shall make an investigation is the language.
Mr. Hancock, does the commission have any ability to rely on prudential reasons at all, or any slightly different question, any enforcement discretion at all? And if so, what's its scope and who can wield it?
It can, but it cannot at the merits checkpoints. So at the point at which this case was dismissed after a reason to believe deadlock, that decision review must occur on the merits. And assertions of discretion, resource, and priority concerns are beside the point to that merits review. And
So suppose all six commissioners agree that this case is just not worth pursuing because there's just not enough on the line. It's worth $1 and it would cost $1 million to investigate. If all six commissioners agree with that, they nonetheless have to reach a merits determination, in your view?
If we're already at the point where they have taken a vote on reason to believe, they can vote in favor of dismissal on prosecutorial discretion grounds before we get to the reason to believe decision point. But once they have taken the step of voluntarily taking a vote on reason to believe, there is an obligation stated by this court in DCCC and again later in Common Cause that they need to explain in the statement of reasons why it is that they voted against reason to believe, which is, again, a merits question. Saying in a statement of reasons, well, here's our legal analysis, but also take the statement of reasons in this case, for example, we don't think we have sufficient resources or it's not a priority to investigate here. That doesn't aid a court in deciding whether the commission was legally required to investigate.
Remember, again, I'm not sure I understand the timing point, because if all six, let's just take a case where it's all six commissioners and they agree that it's not worth it to go forward because the case just doesn't map onto our enforcement priorities, and given the amount of resources that it would take to investigate, it's just not worth the candle. So if they can do that at the outset, and that results in a dismissal, right?
Correct. Yeah. So long as there's majority support. Yes.
So, right. So I'm just assuming one where everybody agrees. So it's unanimous.
Right.
If they can do that at the outset, you're saying they just, if because somebody the procedures call for a reason to believe vote. They can't decide not to find a reason to believe for the same reason. They all six say, okay, we're now at the reason to believe stage, but we just don't think it's worth it to go forward in this case. So we're not going to find a reason to believe a violation has occurred because we just don't want to get to that question of whether there's a reason to believe a violation has occurred. We just don't think it's worth going forward. So we're going to dismiss.
Well, the commission can do that prior to the reason to believe vote. And the commission indeed does do that often.
And can it do that right after the reason to believe vote? Like the reason to believe vote says, well, on the statute, and under your theory, where the reason to believe vote is just focused on reason to believe as a statutory matter, or maybe statutory and allegations and evidence at that point. But if the prudential reasons are excluded there, could, once the commission said, well, yeah, on the statute, there may be reason to believe, can they then turn around right after that and say, but six of us think this is not worth the candle?
And dismiss. At that point, the commission would be obligated to conduct an investigation. So no, I don't think the commission could just turn around and do that. Again, the
can
shall
they at any time vote to dismiss based on a majority vote?
Based on the language of the statute, yes. Yes, the vote to dismiss is available.
The statute expressly contemplates dismissal even at an early stage of the case before the target has been given its right to file a response.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that
just seems very formalistic. If you assume, as you did, that a dismissal on discretionary grounds at the outset, before any vote on reason to believe, would not be unlawfully premature. But then if they package that issue with the reason to believe and they just do it in one order and they have some legal reasoning and have some discretionary reason, it just becomes unlawful because they do it in one step rather than two?
Well, I think the purpose of the reason to believe vote and the probable cause to believe vote are very important under the structure of the act. So the private right of action that exists as a safety valve to correct for the under enforcement that would understandably occur due to the commission's bipartisan structure. And so these two merits checkpoints are in the act, in the enforcement process. So there is a checkpoint at which the commission, if they choose to get to that point, are required to take a stand on the merits. So a court can determine.
Sure, but it's not a checkpoint that disables a discretionary dismissal.
So that's correct, because the language of the act changes at later points along the road of the enforcement process. So, for example, the decision whether to file an enforcement lawsuit under 3109A6, that language there, in contrast to the reason to believe language, is the commission may choose to file such a lawsuit. The contrast in that language between shall and may must have content. It must have meaning. The reason why DCCC and Common Cause said specifically the controlling commissioners are obligated to explain why they voted against no reason to believe is in order to determine whether the commission violated its duty to go forward and investigate or not.
Well, they declined to vote that there is a reason to believe, but they can decline to vote that there is a reason to believe for the same discretionary reasons that they could have declined to have a reason to believe vote to begin with, which is to say, we've now looked into it and we think, pick your prudential reason, and this one, let's just stick with the resources one. It's just not worth it.
I mean, I think there's lacking a rational connection between the facts found and the choice made between taking a no reason to believe vote, voting against reason to believe, which again is saying the reason to believe standard is, has the complainant stated a credible claim? So by voting against reason to believe, you're taking a stand and saying, I don't think the complainant has stated a credible claim here.
No, they're not. What they say is, I'm not going to find that there's reason to believe a violation has occurred. I think that's the language of the statute, if I'm remembering right. You can correct me. I think the language statute is find reason to believe that a violation has occurred. And the vote is, I'm not going to make that finding. I'm not going to make a finding that there's a reason to believe a violation has occurred. Why are you not making that finding? Because I don't want to get to that finding. Because I think, like apparently the way you're looking at it, I could have said at the very outset that I think this case is not worth the candle. I still think that. And that's what I'm saying now. And that's why I'm not going to make the finding that the reason to believe a violation has occurred. I'm not, I don't understand why it would be the case that you have to do that at the very outset, and you can't do that very same thing later when maybe you have a little more information, you actually have a better sense of what the claim is about, and you have a better sense of how the prudential considerations wash out in the balance.
I mean, I don't think it would be unreasonable to ask the controlling commissioners to actually make a decision on the merits of the reason to believe point, given that they've had ample opportunity prior to that point to do a preliminary assessment of the merits and dismiss on discretionary grounds if they see fit. And the commission actually does this.
So are you suggesting that there does need to be a reason to believe legal assessment, and then you can also have a purely discretionary reason also, but you at least need to assess this from a legal standpoint first?
The legal assessment is essential. Commissioners can and do often add prudential and discretionary reasons to their statement of reasons, but I think for purposes of judicial review in determining whether the dismissal at the reason to believe stage was contrary to law, that analysis has to be conducted on the merits, and the prudential reasons they're effectively dicta at that point.
Well, then with respect to the purely discretionary reasons, even under this example, if you just say, oh, it's just going to cost too much, why can't the court also test those purely discretionary reasons? And the reason I say that is if this statute is designed to deal with political corruption, then what if one of the reasons was, I don't want to pay for testing these issues with respect to Democrat candidates or Republican candidates? Do we not get to test that from an abuse of discretion standpoint, just like we do in other contexts?
You do, Your Honor. We agree with that. We think, given the language of the cause of action in 3109A8, that provides for judicial review of any dismissal, right, unattached from whether it's a merits dismissal or any other kind of dismissal, that if that demeans something, review has to be available at any point in the process. The question, though, is with the merits checkpoints, review is conducted on the basis of the merits, since, the commissioners need to explain the merits vote that they took.
But what we review is a dismissal. So on your hypothesis, the statutory language can be read as you are reading it to say the reason to believe vote is a vote about the statutory question or statutory and factual question of whether there's a reason to believe. But in order for the private right of action to arise, there has to be a dismissal, an order of dismissal. And that is typically a separate vote. It was a separate vote in this case to close the file. And that's what's being reviewed. So if the commissioners, not within the confines of the reason to believe vote, but separately say, and here are all these prudential reasons, this is worth $1 and it's going to cost $1 million to litigate, and a majority decides to dismiss on that ground, then we have to review the prudential reasons and the statutory reasons. No?
I think that's contrary to DCCC. DCCC said that when there is I'll call it a deadlock dismissal, but Your Honor is right. It is two distinct analytical steps. There's the vote to find reason to believe that deadlocks 3-3 here, and then there's a subsequent vote to dismiss, which has to be supported by a majority. DCCC teaches that where a vote to dismiss is precipitated by a deadlock on the reason to believe question, the controlling commissioners need to provide a statement of reasons that explains their vote on the reason to believe vote, even though there was a subsequent dismissal that's analytically a distinct step.
There were no other reasons in that case. And I'm imagining if we were to clarify along the lines of what you're saying, that the reason to believe vote is a statutory question applying law to fact, then prudential considerations would not be banished, because we've said countless times that the FEC has discretion, but they would belong in a separate statement. And presumably one would have to roll those together and make something of it, no?
Again, respectfully, Your Honor, I do think that runs headlong into DCCC and common cause.
But there were no separate statements of reason there.
Well, and that's because the FEC argued that none were required, because they argued that a deadlock dismissal was per se prosecutorial discretion. And this court said, even assuming that's right, even assuming you don't need to explain a deadlock dismissal because it just is prosecutorial discretion by its nature, it's still subject to review. And presumably a 6-0 vote of the commission dismissing would be a stronger practice of a stronger practice or action of prosecutorial discretion, but that would still be reviewable as well.
Right. And that's the opinion in DCCC. We said that.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
So Mr. Hancock, is there, I mean, where in DCCC does it suggest that part of the statement of reasons could not be to say that the commission is asserting prosecutorial discretion? I mean, DCCC requires reasons, but it's your view seems to be that those reasons cannot include prosecutorial discretion at all.
Well, DCCC's specific language, and I'm paraphrasing, is that the controlling commissioners must explain why they voted against the commission's reading of precedent and voting against reason to believe. It's specific about, so when I say the commission, I mean actually the Office of General Counsel. So the Office of General Counsel, their recommended reason to believe. And the reason to believe vote, commissioners, the controlling commissioners voted against the Office of General Counsel's recommendation and its reading of precedent. And DCCC is specific that the vote against the Office of General Counsel's reading of precedent is the thing that needs to be explained. And you know, prudential reasons just don't fit into that equation because the recommendation by OGC was one on the merits. Here's why you should find that why there's reason to believe.
So the statement of reasons, in your view, cannot rely on prosecutorial discretion at all, that's just simply not part of the statement of reasons.
Not at the merits checkpoints. So reason to believe and probable cause to believe. And
how does that view square with Aikens, where the Supreme Court specifically recognizes that the FEC still retains prosecutorial discretion?
Well, the FEC retains significant prosecutorial discretion. So the FEC never has to go forward if it doesn't want to, even if a court is defined that its dismissal is contrary to law. Again, the reviewing court corrects any legal error. The FEC gets a chance on remand to correct error if there is error, and then potentially a private right of action could be triggered to go forward. In no case does the FEC, if the FEC says we don't, as it has here in this statement of reasons, that we don't feel like going forward because of resource and priority concerns. If a reviewing court here found the legal reasoning and statement of reasons contrary to law, in no case would the FEC ever have to go forward despite its prudential concerns, which may not be shared by the private complainant.
What happens? So if all six commissioners agree at the very outset, let's just say for argument purposes, just for now, we'll put aside this question of whether discretionary grounds like enforcement priorities can surface when you're talking about the reason to believe stage. Let's just back it up to the beginning where even you think discretionary considerations can lead to a dismissal. So let's say at the outset, six commissioners decide uniformly that we're not going to go forward with this complaint and we're going to dismiss it because this type of violation just isn't our priority. It's type of violation A. We really care about type of violation B. This is a type of violation A case. Everybody agrees it's a type of violation A case. We're just not going to expend our resources on a A case. We're waiting for B cases. And they dismiss for that reason. And then somebody brings a challenge and says, I'm challenging the dismissal, which the statute allows for a petition to challenge a dismissal. And I'm challenging the dismissal as contrary to law. What do you think would happen with that challenge? Is that determination by six commissioners that I choose not to go forward and we collectively therefore choose not to go forward because this is a type A case. This is not our priority. We're prioritizing type B cases. Is that amenable to being overturned on the ground that that decision about priorities was contrary to law?
Yes. Yes. I think even the commission.
What's the law that priority choice would be said to contradict?
So there are long-stated legal standards governing reasoned judicial decision-making, which wouldn't second-guess any of those prudential considerations, but do set up important guardrails that protect against arbitrary executive branch action. And to go back to the example we provided in our brief, if you know, this would obviously be a very rare situation and wouldn't be likely to occur often, but like if the commission said, we're dismissing case A because it was filed by Republicans, that would clearly be out of bounds. And so a reviewing court could review the discretionary reasons under that standard of review. The content of that is traceable back to the statute. So arbitrary or capricious agency action, can be found to be so because it's inconsistent with the statute. So one example would be DCCC's requirement that a statement of reasons need to be provided to facilitate judicial review. DCCC says, we find that that's necessary because the statute provides for judicial review. In order to make that meaningful, you need to have a statement of reasons explaining what the commission actually did. Or if a dismissal were based upon, say, racial or partisan bias, we've cited Labatt as an example of this. The court there said that would be arbitrary and capricious agency action. It would be because nothing in FECA supports dismissing a case on such grounds.
What if the dismissal were type A is any case dealing with coordinated expenditures? They say, we just don't want to do those cases. And even if six members did it, I mean, wouldn't it matter a lot on not just whether they've said this is our priority, and even if a majority says this is our priority, but whether that is a reasoned basis rather than, let's say, an abdication of a whole part of the statutory enforcement responsibility?
Yes, I think that does risk being an abdication, such a kind of blanket and express policy of not pursuing a certain type of...
But if it were very well explained, one could imagine that it might not be. So it's going to depend on context, on the nature of the explanation. I guess what I'm resisting is the idea that you can look at sort of a very short kind of magic words assertion of discretion, whether to frustrate review or assuming review to decide the question of contrary to law. I mean, you need something more.
And I think the court could demand more if the reasons given were not sufficient. To be clear, at these points in the process outside of the merits checkpoints, I think the court can review whatever reasons the commission puts forth. So if there is a mixture of discretionary reasons with a preliminary assessment of the merits, which so often is the case, really those two things go hand in hand, as Heckler itself recognized and as New Republican has recognized in its brief, that it risks being arbitrary to dismiss a case on purely prudential grounds if there was absolutely no preliminary assessment of the merits involved. Because then how can you know what it is that you're...
So you can't have that, you think, a dismissal based on purely discretionary grounds?
I mean, I don't think I would go so far as to say it's like categorically impossible, but I do think that when you get to the end of the sliding scale, you do risk having it being arbitrary. Because again, like, how can one make the assessment that an agency doesn't have the resources necessary to tackle a particular case unless you know what's entailed in that particular case? Almost by definition, a look at what the case is all about and what the merits of the case are all about is necessary. In this case, in the statement of reasons.
There are cases that turn on disputed legal questions, and there are a lot of cases that don't. The law is straightforward, and they're just making an assessment whether the case is worth it.
And the evaluation that the law is straightforward might be something that a reviewing court could take a look at to see if that is an unreasonable assessment of the case law. There would be legal questions built into that. This case presents a similar example. So the controlling commissioners, in the page of their statement of reasons that explain their discretionary concerns, they say part of the reason they don't want to go forward and investigate and think that it would take too many resources is they claim it would involve probing Senator Scott's subjective intent to determine when exactly it is they became a candidate. But we submit that's an error of law. There's clear majority-supported commission precedent stating that the candidacy inquiry is actually objective and can be done on the basis of the candidate's objective activities. If that were corrected and sent back down to the commission, those commissioners might rethink their assertion of discretion. Maybe the investigation wouldn't take that long under a correct assessment of the law after the court.
Isn't it important that it takes 4 votes to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion, but it only takes 3 votes to deadlock and require this statement of reasons? I ask you that because it seems to me that the case law that identifies a controlling group, that arises from the fact that in order to move forward with an enforcement, we need 4 votes that there's reason to believe a violation has occurred. And the 3 no-go commissioners in a deadlock are the controlling group because they didn't provide the 4th vote to move forward. So that's why they're the controlling group, and that's the controlling decision. If that no-go group adds, and we also rely on prosecutorial discretion, that's just the vote of 3 commissioners. That's not 4 votes to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion, which is what is necessary. And it seems to me that a vote of no discretion by 3 commissioners is not controlling because it doesn't control anything. 3 commissioners can vote, no prosecutorial, we're going to rely on prosecutorial discretion. But if 4 vote reason to believe, it goes forward. So the 3 vote, no prosecutorial discretion vote has no controlling authority at all. It seems to me that that's superfluous to the reason to believe issue, which is controlling. And I think this case seems to really illustrate that, because in this case, we have a certification at the dismissal stage in which 3 commissioners said, we're relying on prosecutorial discretion, Heckler versus Cheney. But 5 commissioners said, let's just close the file. So it seems on this record, it's very plain that the statement of 3 commissioners that we're relying on prosecutorial discretion is not the position of the commission. And so after the fact, they write their statement of reasons, which they get to write because they are controlling with respect to the reason to believe finding. But if they add into that, oh, and prosecutorial discretion, that's not the position of the commission, is it?
No, Your Honor, and I agree with your assessment, and you've stated that much better than I have. I think that is an accurate assessment, and it is an implementation of DCCC. And it reminds me of a more recent example of this court implementing that idea. So in the other End Citizens United PAC case, ECU1, I'll call it, I think it was a 2023 decision where this court held that a statement of reasons issued 2 months after dismissal was post hoc rationalization that could not be considered to explain the dismissal. The counsel for the FEC in that case argued, well, on the record, there's a deadlocked reason to believe vote that needs to be explained, but there's also a deadlocked vote to dismiss on Heckler v. Cheney grounds. And the counsel for the FEC argued, well, we can just look to that vote as the explanation for why the controlling commissioners, and they were the same commissioners, of course, who voted on those both votes. We can look to that vote to explain why it is that the controlling commissioners voted against reason to believe, since we don't have a contemporaneous statement to do that work for us. And this court rejected that in that case and said specifically, no, looking to DCCC and common cause, the statement of reasons needs to explain the deadlocked reason to believe vote, and a failed Heckler vote doesn't control.
I'm sorry, which case was that?
It's End Citizens United v. FEC. It's a 2023 decision.
Mr. Hancock, but why would we think that a statement of reasons from 3 commissioners is what we should review when they give legal reasons, but not when they give prosecutorial discretion reasons? So either DCCC allows this court to review the opinion of 3 commissioners or whatever the controlling commissioners are, 2 or 3, when they discuss law, but not when they rely on prosecutorial discretion. Why would that be the case?
I think, again, because the prosecutorial discretion answers don't answer the legal question that's before the court on review. Again, given the statutory structure, there's the obligation of the FEC to go forward and investigate if reason to believe exists. And so the court must determine, does reason to believe exist? And the FEC voted no.
No, but I took in your response to Judge Pan to be that when there are only 3 commissioners, relying on a particular ground, that that is not something that we should review. I mean, that would just undermine DCCC altogether.
Well, I think it's distinguishable because, again, the issue in DCCC was, well, we need reasons for why you voted against reasonably, why no RTB, and was specific about how...
For that, you can look to only three commissioners or fewer than four.
Those are the three commissioners that prevented the commission from going forward. At that point in the process, there's two choices. There's find reason to believe and go forward, or there's dismiss. And when the commission takes the dismissal off ramp for the reason that there's no RTB, no reason to believe, it has taken a stand on a merits question for which it needs to explain itself to a reviewing court so that review can be conducted to see if the FEC violated that duty that shall make an investigation duty in 3109A2. That language is very close, very similar to the language that existed in Dunlop versus Bukowski that Heckler itself put its seal of approval on as language that circumscribes an agency's ability to discriminate among what cases it shall or shall not approve. The language in that case was that the labor secretary, if they find probable cause to believe, they shall file a civil action. And Heckler said, now that is an example of language that rebuts the Heckler presumption because there is this merits checkpoint, which provides standards to apply in determining whether the dismissal was legal or not.
But it seems like I'm not sure why you are struggling over the nature of the reasoning, because it seems like the Supreme Court has told us in Heckler and in Overton Park and in ICC versus Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers that Congress decides if a type of determination is reviewable. And here that would be the order dismissing the complaint is reviewable. And here it's the statute says, and the Supreme Court has said, this type of order is subject to judicial review. And we don't, you know, as the FEC and the Republicans have argued, we don't carve out, just as, you know, we don't carve out reasons of a different character and change the nature of the susceptibility of that order to review. It's reviewable. And if it's reviewable, then, you know, you can argue about how the reasons are structured and whether statutory reason is forced by the reason to believe vote as a separate vote. But the end of the day, your strongest argument is Congress said this is a reviewable kind of action and it doesn't become unreviewable because some of the reasons seem similar to the reasons that support the categorical but rebuttable presumption of unreviewability under Heckler.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And that would be my second reason for why we believe the Crewe case is erred. Commissioner reasons put forth in support of a reviewable action can't overrule Congress's choice to make that action reviewable. And that's in effect what the Crewe cases do. It puts that power in the hands of three, two, possibly even just one commissioner to decide when or when not Congress's provision for judicial review shall pertain. And that's a separation of powers problem. Appellees argue that there'd be separation of powers problem if the Crewe cases aren't overturned, if they are overturned. We believe the separation of powers problem exists right now because the ability of those commissioners to effectively change what Congress made a reviewable action to something that's categorically unreviewable usurps congressional power to decide what actions shall or shall not be reviewable. And then by extension, it also gives those commissioners the power to effectively make law. The law that they include in those statement of reasons that also have discretionary reasons tacked on ends up being unreviewable and treated like commission precedent within the agency. And Your Honors, I apologize. I see my time has expired. And
Mr. Hancock, I was going to change topics.
Yeah, me too.
One of your theories for standing is informational standing. What's the information that you've been denied?
There are at least two categories of information we've been denied. So First, New Republican, if they had properly reported their relationship with Senator Scott during the time where Senator Scott controls New Republican, they would have to report the value of their in-kind contributions to the Scott campaign. And they would have to disaggregate the value of those contributions from what they have reported as a super PAC. They've reported in bulk their aggregated operating expenditures.
And do you know these figures, or are you trying to figure out these figures?
We're trying to figure out these figures. We don't have, this is information that we lack and which supports informational standing. I would direct this court's attention to what I'll call the correct the record case. So it's a CLC versus FEC case from 2022, which presents, presents nearly identical facts between a super PAC called Correct the Record and the Hillary Clinton campaign.
We were not en banc there, right?
Understood.
Yeah. Well, has Senator Scott declared for an upcoming election?
Senator Scott has declared for 2030, yes.
Okay. If you win and you get some new information about Senator Scott and New Republic, what's your argument for how that would meaningfully help you in his next election 6 years from now?
Well, I guess I would first point out that I'm not aware of any ruling by this court placing kind of a deadline for the usefulness of information sought by a campaign finance watchdog. So in Correct the Record, Clinton was no longer a candidate at all 4 years after the 2016 election had expired. But the information still ends up being valuable given that Senator Scott is obviously an office holder. Information about the spending that resulted his being put in office would be important. So ECU is a multifaceted organization. It operates as a campaign finance watchdog. It tracks spending and politics. It highlights campaign finance issues for the public. It issues reports and communications to third parties. And it uses this information for resource allocation decisions. And so information about the spending that led to Senator Scott's being put in office would be valuable to them and would further their efforts to defend and implement campaign finance reform, which this court has said on many occasions is sufficient to establish informational standing. I might also point to Aikens itself, which of course is the seminal case in this area. So Aikens, the PAC, the respondent, the PAC that was at issue for which the plaintiffs were trying to get information, the alleged activity that the plaintiffs claimed supporting them supporting the idea that the commission should have held them as a super PAC, it took place between 1980 and 1990, and Aikens held in 1998 that the plaintiffs there had informational standing based upon information that they claimed should have been reported during the previous decade. So I think if that is sufficient, then certainly we're within that here.
Mr. Hancock, in Aikens, there was standing for voters. So is ECU here claiming organizational standing or associational standing on behalf of voters? I didn't see that in the briefing.
It is not.
But the way you've described ECU, it seems that your grounds of standing would be associational or organizational.
It is not, but this court has held on several occasions that an organization seeking information about a PAC need not be a membership organization with voters or, you know, trying to obtain that information in order to.
How is that reconcilable with TransUnion?
Well, so no court has ever applied TransUnion in the context of informational standing and FICA. TransUnion itself distinguishes cases, distinguish Aikens and cases involving FOIA. But then in any event, even under TransUnion, I think informational standing exists here because the informational standing was found to exist there because of the possibility that erroneous information would have been passed on to third parties by the actors in TransUnion. And that's precisely what could occur here, right? ECU, again, as part of its programmatic activities, communicates with the public about campaign finance information. And so to the extent FEC reporting is inaccurate or late or absent, that affects the accuracy of what ECU can communicate to the public who is interested in what ECU has to say.
Let me make sure.
One more. Suppose that when the controlling commissioners, following a deadlock, give a statement of reasons, it is unreviewable to the extent it rests on legal reasoning, unreviewable to the extent it rests on prosecutorial discretion. I know you resist that, but just humor me. And just help me think, how would we unpack a statement like that that has strands of both? Is it, I can think of, maybe you say the legal error might be reviewable, but if it's clear, there's no prejudice if the prosecutorial discretion independently supports the result. Maybe you analogize to something like an independent and adequate state ground doctrine, another area where you have to figure out what the order was based on. Like, how should we, if you don't like locomotive engineers applied for the principle that if there's any mention of prosecutorial discretion, the whole thing is unreviewable. So what other criteria should we use if we want to unpack it in the way that I'm suggesting?
Well, I think in that scenario, and again, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question, this assumes that the discretionary reasons are unreviewable. Right. I think
giving you a chance to win on a fallback.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Aiken speaks to this scenario. Aiken itself says even when there's a discretionary act by an agency, review still exists in order to determine whether there was an improper legal ground involved. And so, I think it makes sense for courts to assume or presume, absent significant indications to the contrary, that when you have a statement that has merits analysis and discretionary reasons, that there is a relationship between those two. To the extent that, again, a classic prosecutorial discretion decision is based upon a preliminary look at the merits that informs those discretionary considerations. Even New Republican in this case concedes that. I think Heckler makes that point as well. And so to the extent that that's true, it would make sense for a court to review the legal analysis. And if there's legal error, to identify that legal error, to send it back to the commission. And the commission then can decide, now under our corrected understanding of the law, we would still exercise discretion anyway, perhaps under a right understanding of the law. And given that, there would be no advisory opinion problem, as Aikens explained.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question about the back end of this process? Because the way I think it's supposed to work is, if there's a review for whether a decision was contrary to law, court issues a declaration, and then the commission has an opportunity to conform to the declaration. And if they don't conform, then the citizen suit can proceed. If the declaration says there is reason to believe a violation occurred, and the commission then says, now we understand your legal analysis, we still want to exercise our discretion not to enforce. Is there an argument to be made that the commission has not conformed? Because if there's reason to believe, they have to investigate, don't they?
I think that's exactly right. And I think in the face of a district court order saying that there's reason to believe on these facts, and it would be unreasonable to find otherwise, that anything other than moving forward under that understanding of the correct understanding of the law would be contrary to law, especially given, as Your Honor identified, that duty to go forward and investigate. And again, I stress.
Sorry, does the reviewing court make the reason to believe decision or just expose legal error and then send it back for them to decide whether there's reason to believe in light of the correct understanding?
It exposes legal error, but as part of that analysis under Orlowski, the second prong of Orlowski, a reviewing court could decide that the commission's determination under a correct understanding of FECA that reasonably didn't exist on a certain set of facts was unreasonable. And so then that could result in a reviewing court saying it was unreasonable to find no reason to believe on these facts, given the correct understanding of the law.
But that's not the way abuse of discretion review normally works. I mean, a court would only do that if the court would find that essentially no reasonable lower court or no reasonable agency exercising its discretion applying the correct principles of law could come up with, they could only come up with one conclusion. And, you know, I think you can search the federal reporters and you will find very few cases where an appellate court has done that.
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't know that it would be a common scenario, but I think there are examples of district courts which have done that. The Common Cause Georgia case that we have cited in our briefing comes to mind.
Has this court done that?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure. I can't categorically say one way or the other.
Reason to believe is a very tentative early stage decision, pre-investigation. And so it would seem a lot for a court to decide not only expose a legal error, but sort of take over the agency's job. We don't do that as a matter of agency law, virtually ever, unless, as Judge Wilkins said, there's no other rational way to look at that. And that seems to be an extraordinary assumption. I think the assumption is that we expose legal error and send it back. And the statute seems to assume that because we send it back to them to do something. And if they don't act on it, then the private cause of action arises. They have the opportunity to not act. It just gives rise to a private cause of action.
Correct. They have a right of first refusal to correct the error identified by the court.
Right. Right. And if I could follow up one other thing in response to Judge Katz's question about your fallback, you said absent something extraordinary, the legal reasons would be reviewable under the theory that that could then inform the prosecutorial decision by the commission on remand. What did you reserve in your absence? I don't have your exact formulation, but you said something extraordinary or something quite unusual. What would that be? Would that be the block of three naysayers saying it's an independent grant, as an independent ground, we actually reclaim our prosecutorial discretion reasons?
Your Honor, I don't know that had a specific scenario in my mind. I was just trying to avoid being absolutely categorical about it. But I do think like there is. So,
well, see, we have to write opinions.
Of course.
With rules.
I think new models is a good example. I think part of the error in new models was to assume or you know, that. The legal analysis, the 30 some odd pages of legal analysis was so intertwined with the eventual exercise of discretion that given the relationship there.
So what if you had a situation in which just to follow up on what Judge Millett asked, what if you have the same situation, but then the controlling commissioners say, and even if everything we've said so far about the law is wrong, it's still not going to matter because we still wouldn't go forward. Because as a matter of resource expenditures and enforcement priorities, we think this is not the kind of case that warrants going forward.
Well, in our view, there's review of the prosecutor, the discretionary reasons as well. So
right. So but I think the way that's teed up was that you have to assume that there's not understanding that you resist that assumption. But if you just will resist that assumption for a second and engage on the theory that there are discretionary grounds that are unreviewable. And then there's also legal grounds that everybody agrees would be reviewable. But the statement is just made plain on the face of the statement of reasons. Even if everything we say about the legal grounds is just wrong, and we think this is our best view of the law, but we acknowledge that there's room for debate. It might just flatly be wrong. It wouldn't matter because we still wouldn't go forward for the following discretionary and by assumption unreviewable reasons.
I hesitate because I think that would set up a potentially very easy evasion of judicial review just by using particular magic words to evade review.
I thought your position is that it's reviewable. You're defending Orlowski, under which contrary to law review includes review of discretionary grounds. So it would all, so I mean, that is resisting the hypothetical.
That's the point. Trying to get you not to resist that.
That's why I wasn't, Your Honor.
Right. Yeah, but if we're in a world where, and this is just hypothesizing, the court were to hold that claims about prosecutorial judgments and resources by three are not reviewable. Full stop. Absent, assuming first they say they are completely independent, as Chief Judge Srinivasan proposed, and there's nothing facially illegitimate. It's not, we only go after Democrats or Republicans. Right. We are overwhelmed. This one looks to us like it's moot. The entities don't exist anymore. They want us to say someone should have filed something when they didn't file it. We can't go back in time and fix it. This one is, there's nothing productive that the commission could do here in the narrowed circumstances of this case. Full stop. And so we would still vote against going forward, even if we were wrong on the law. He's just accepting for the answer, for purposes of answering this question, that we will not review that. We've said that. Then do you lose, or then do you envision this statute as saying that, look, they gave legal reasons. We assume that those will have relevant effect on remand, on reconsideration, if we point that out to them, and then we will send it back. And if they still feel the way they are, they can either all vote to dismiss or they can do nothing.
The latter scenario, Your Honor, and because going back to Judge Pillard's point, that Congress made dismissals reviewable actions, and if there's reviewable reasons given for taking a reviewable action, then a reviewing court needs to be able to look at those reasons. There's law to apply. Not doing so, I think, again, runs into serious separation of powers concerns, especially in light of Loper-Bright, which, of course, held that courts shouldn't even defer to an agency's interpretation of the law, let alone let it go unreviewable and let an agency or a minority even of an agency have final say on the meaning of the law.
Well, then I'm back to where I started, which is, did you really mean to hedge when you said absent extraordinary circumstances or something unusual in response to Judge Katsas?
I suppose I misspoke, Your Honor.
There could be some other scenario you're thinking about.
I probably got tangled up in the hypotheticals, but in a world where the action could be rendered. So here's my confusion. Under the Crewe cases, basing a dismissal on prosecutorial discretion grounds renders the action an unreviewable action. In that world, then yes, I think if the discretionary reasons are, if it's bulletproof that they are independent and they form an independent basis, then yes, then you have what the Crewe cases held, which is that it insulates the legal reasons from review. But if part of the hypothetical is which I believe we're operating in, which is where Congress has made the action of dismissal reviewable full stop, then yes, this court, a reviewing court, can review reviewable legal reasons, again, given to justify that reviewable action.
Then the next argument from your friends is going to be, and I'm in the hypothetical situation here where we're not reviewing the claims about prosecutorial resources. Why isn't that an advisory opinion for us to opine upon the law when these people who are, whose explanation we're reviewing have said, and we don't care about the law. At the end of the day, it would have no effect on our decision.
I think the answer to that is Aikens, that a court cannot know and should not presume to know whether the commission would exercise its discretion in the same way under a correct understanding of the law.
Even if they say, we don't believe them.
I apologize.
Even if they say, we come to the same, even if we're all, as Chief Judge Srinivasan said, even if we are dead wrong on the law, we still would vote against reason to believe for discretionary reasons.
I think the only way to test that and to ensure that it's not in service of just an evasion of judicial review of the legal reasons would be to send it back.
I guess I would have thought you would have added that the decision would affect the right of a private right of action to go forward. It has still legal consequences in this case, which it doesn't normally.
Absolutely. That's true.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions.
Yes. Mr. Hancock, I did want to ask you about Orlovsky and give you a chance to maybe put forth your best argument from the text of FECA for why we should review for reasonableness or arbitrary and capricious review. I mean, FECA says we review for contrary to law. Throughout the U.S. Code, there are statutes that either point to the APA standards, which include arbitrary and capricious review, or there are many statutes that use some variation of the APA formulation. But FECA is actually quite distinct in referring only to contrary to law. And so I'd like to understand your best argument from the text and structure of FECA for why Orlovsky is correct. Because I didn't see very much argument from the text in your brief. So
I think as the court and commission, the split panel and commission on hope recognized, the contrary to law language mirrors not in accordance with law from APA 706A2. And the text of APA 706A2, we believe, makes clear, given the word otherwise in that sentence, that arbitrary and capricious abuse of discretion are merely forms of being not in accordance with law.
Why should we read contrary to law and not in accordance with law to mean the same thing? It's not clear to me that historically those are in fact entirely overlapping concepts. Do you have any historical evidence for why they would be that way?
Not that I could point to at this moment, Your Honor, I apologize, but I think I would point to APA 559, mm-hmm. which states that provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act that are not expressly excluded by an organic statute still come forth and apply. And so nothing in FECA precludes APA 706-2A from being harmonized with the contrary to law standard, which is what Orlovsky did in enunciating a standard.
And nothing
review.
In FECA then explicitly overturns an agency's prosecutorial discretion either. 559 is not perhaps a very helpful provision for your view, given the strong underlying presumption of prosecutorial discretion for executive branch agencies.
I think the work of rebutting APA 701A2, again, is done by FECA's express cause of action for judicial review of dismissals. And again, the duty to go forward upon reason to believe or probable cause to believe merits findings. And so, given that if there was nothing in FECA that rebutted 701A2, then yes, given APA 559, it could come forth and apply, but FECA successfully rebuts it. And so 701A2 remains in the background, but there's nothing similar that would prevent 706-2A, the arbitrary capricious abuse of discretion standard, from being applicable and again being harmonized with the contrary to law standard.
Finish your thought, please.
Your Honor was interested in the textual arguments for why this is the correct understanding of contrary to law. I would also submit that 3109A8, it contains a cause of action not only to challenge a commission dismissal, but also a cause of action to challenge commission failures to act or delay. And the Supreme Court in Track and this court in or this court has repeatedly said that the track factors and the common cause factors are the factors courts are to apply in deciding whether FEC delay is contrary to law. And those factors explicitly rest on factual and discretionary reasons that overlap with the type of discretionary reasons that are put forth in support.
But after 45 committee, the FEC can remedy a failure to act simply by taking a reason to believe vote. And even if it's deadlocked, that satisfies the failure to act holding.
It can remedy a failure to act in the conformance period by deadlocking on reason to believe. But I think our larger point is that there's overlap between the discretionary reasons that that potentially qualify as contrary to law. So if in the failure to act context, the commission's discretionary reasons for not moving faster can be found contrary to law under FECA in a failure to act claim, it would make no sense to interpret contrary to law, this exact same standard in a different way, just for purposes of dismissal suits under the same provision. I would say that's the strongest textual evidence.
Mention of Heckler versus Cheney and non-review of agency exercises of prosecutorial discretion. Other than the two Crew cases, are you aware of any case where when you have a multi-member decision-making body, that concerns about use of resources or other discretionary judgments have been treated as the agency's exercise of prosecutorial discretion?
I am not aware of
And Heckler precludes review of an agency's exercise of prosecutorial discretion. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay. When three commissioners say, well, here's what we think, is that an agency's exercise of prosecutorial discretion? Even if we look at their reasons as part of our analysis?
No, but I would submit that, so there's nothing in FECA that FECA creates one dismissal and made it reviewable. And there isn't another type of dismissal that's a prosecutorial discretion dismissal that could possibly be exercised even by a majority of the commission. Prosecutorial discretion, as the FEC's own policy statement says, is a rationale for dismissing. It's not an action in and of itself. So I don't think even four or five or six commissioners could kind of press the prosecutorial discretion action button because that doesn't exist in order to try to insulate review. It always remains just a reason that can't overturn Congress's decision to make dismissals reviewable.
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from, we'll give you some time for rebuttal. We'll hear from the commission next. Ms. Ward.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Shana Ward for the Federal Election Commission. The panel decisions in this case, New Models, and Commission on Hope all relied on a well-reasoned principle of law. A commission dismissal of an administrative complaint is unreviewable if the dismissal turns in whole or in part on prosecutorial discretion. This principle reflects a thoughtful application of FECA and longstanding circuit and Supreme Court precedent. What these cases have made clear is that there are two categories of cases. First, those that are reviewable under FECA's contrary to law standard because they relied on an interpretation of the law. And second, those that are presumptively unreviewable because the agency exercised its inherent prosecutorial discretion. These cases reflect a plain reading of the contrary to law standard. FECA does not limit the commission's enforcement discretion by providing specific requirements for the exercise of that discretion. Thus, when the commission weighs practical enforcement considerations, FECA provides no law to apply. And therefore, these decisions are left within the agency's inherent decision-making.
I'm a little concerned that you could always inject prosecutorial discretion on any of these decisions going forward and then lead to this type of deadlock when the statute was designed to correct any type of political corruption.
What the statute provides, Your Honor, is for reviewability on contrary to law findings. So that is when the commission has made a purely legal decision. That remains reviewable. However, what is within the agency's discretion as set forth in Heckler are those inherent enforcement priorities that are best left within the agency's decision making.
And so can you identify any other area of law, or any other statute where an agency can transform a reviewable action into a non-reviewable action, not just an action entitled to deference, but non-reviewable, just by changing the reasons that it uses in support of that action?
Well, I don't necessarily agree that it's changing the reasons. And I'm not, you know, FECA is a unique statute, and the commission is unique in that manner, that it allows this limited reviewability for contrary to law findings. But I don't take that as far as suggesting that there's somehow a change that's being made when commissioners are making these enforcement decisions. They can make them both at the outset when an administrative complaint comes in. That happens regularly. And that happens not only, by four or more commissioners or five or more commissioners, but rather six or more commissioners can decide at the outset that the case is not one recognizing its enforcement priorities, that it should not go forward. The same is to be said at the reason to believe stage. When that vote happens, commissioners can then decide that this is not one based on these inherent responsibilities that they're in charge of, that this is worth pursuing further than that.
At that stage, though, doesn't it take four votes to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion?
So FECA does not contain an explicit requirement for four votes to dismiss.
But there's a general provision, though, for the commission to take action.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor. 30109 contains a four vote requirement to initiate certain actions, to defend, to initiate an appeal.
Let me ask you this way. If three commissioners want to dismiss, does the case get dismissed?
What happens after that, Your Honor, is that there is a separate vote to close the file.
No, I understand that, but I'm asking you a different question. Just in general, if three commissioners want to dismiss, does the case get dismissed? They call for a vote for dismissal. If three of them want to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion, does the case get dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor. And it happens based on that second vote.
The three votes is enough to dismiss?
So I think there's a couple of different steps. Again, the statute does not specify that a majority is required to dismiss an action. That much is clear. And so when those three votes are at, a split vote dismissal on a reason to believe vote, what happens then?
I'm asking you a different question, which is in general, if three commissioners just want to vote to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion, does the case get dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Take it out of this context.
Sure, I understand, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. That is sufficient in that way, yes.
So what's the statutory basis for that? Because I thought that the statute said that you need four votes to take action.
Right. So the four votes to take action, to initiate an action. And so
dismissal is not an action.
No, Your Honor. And let me take a step back, because I may have mistakenly agreed with that overall principle that three votes are necessary or enough to dismiss, because I was going to highlight the 45 committee case, the recent case, which held that what happens.
I think I'm asking you a really simple question, because you're representing the FEC. And I'm just asking you a question about how do things work at this commission? If three commissioners say we want to vote based on prosecutorial discretion to dismiss this case, does the case get dismissed?
No, Your Honor. What happens then is there needs
to be. So your answer is no.
That's correct.
Okay. So then my question is, in the context of a statement of reasons, which is gets to be made by a controlling no-go, I call them the no-go commissioners. They don't want to move forward. They get to make the statement of reasons because they've controlled the action. The commission can't go forward without four votes. So if three commissioners say, we don't want to go forward, it can't go forward. So they're the controlling minority. So they get to write this statement of reasons. And within their statement of reasons, they throw in, and we rely on prosecutorial discretion. Why is that an action of the commission? Because it takes four votes to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion. these three did stop the enforcement because of the reason to believe finding, but their views about prosecutorial discretion are not controlling. If they voted three votes for prosecutorial discretion, let's not move forward, and four people voted, we have reason to believe, the case would move forward. So three votes for prosecutorial discretion is not a controlling action of the commission, is it?
Well, what the DCCC case held is that in this very limited scenario, those three votes, those the opinions of those commissioners that voted against moving forward on the merits on enforcement are providing the reasons to, and for the court to review why the commission acted as it did.
No, I understand, but it seems to me that what's controlling about what they did is not vote for reason to believe, because they cannot move forward if three commissioners vote, we don't want to move forward. But whatever they say about prosecutorial discretion, why isn't that just superfluous?
Well, it isn't superfluous, Your Honor, because in this scenario, there has to be some ability for, and this is what the DCCC case held, for the court to understand why the commission acted as it did. And because those commissioners are providing those reasons, and if it's based on those enforcement priorities that they've set forth.
But those are their reasons, the three of them. But it would have taken four commissioners to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion, correct?
No, Your Honor. And what happens—
I thought you just agreed to me, with me that that's true.
To clarify, what happens in a split vote dismissal, if there's a 3-3 or a 2-2, whatever the case may be, under that scenario, that has been the vote on reason to believe. That's the vote that matters for purposes of understanding if this action is reviewable. Subsequently, what happens then is a separate vote to close the file. That is the final action that ends and dismisses the case. And
just pin that down. Closing the file dismisses is the same as dismissing the case.
That's in this scenario. And that's where I wanted to point to the court's opinion recently in 45 committee. The court explained, and this is consistent with commission practice, is that a split reason to believe vote does not result in an automatic dismissal of the complaint. Rather, a separate vote to close the file is needed. And the reason why is because otherwise the case would remain in kind of this purgatory stage where nothing has happened.
Right, I just want to clarify that closing the file is the same as dismissing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So in this case, though, there is a certification of dismissal, and it says that three commissioners voted in part on Heckler versus Cheney, which is prosecutorial discretion, but five commissioners voted just to close the file. So the position of the commission is not to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion, based on that certification vote, is it?
The commission's dismissal in that case is, or I'm sorry, the commission is dismissing the file 5-1, and that was the certification. However, the three that decided against finding reason to believe, it's their vote that matters. And I realize this is unique, but it's their vote that matters for purposes of understanding why the commission did not go forward.
But so you're saying that we should assume that the whole commission voted to close based on prosecutorial discretion in the face of explicit evidence that only three of the five commissioners that voted to dismiss relied on prosecutorial discretion?
No, Your Honor. I'm just saying that for purposes of this exercise, we're pointed to the three commissioners that decided against moving forward with an enforcement action to understand why they prevented enforcement from taking place.
And I guess my question is, when we're looking at what they said, why aren't we just focusing on what they said about reason to believe? Because that's what was controlling. Because what they said about prosecutorial discretion, that's just three people who are not able to speak for the commission.
So if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're asking why are we looking just to the statements of those three commissioners?
No, I understand why we look to those three commissioners. It's because they prevented enforcement from happening because we need four votes to enforce. And if three of them don't want to, they're controlling. They've controlled the decision not to move forward. But I'm saying, why does it matter what they say about prosecutorial discretion? Because they're not controlling with respect to a dismissal based on prosecutorial discretion.
Well, it matters again, just for this limited exercise. And I again realize that this is a unique scenario that's based on this court's precedent stemming from DCCC and NRSC and others. For purposes of understanding reviewability, we have to look to those statements and whether or not it's based on a reason to believe or whether it's based on a legal decision, a legal determination, or those inherent enforcement priorities matters for purposes of determining if it's reviewable.
Under the way that the commission's procedures currently work, if the three controlling commissioners decide not to go forward, for reasons having nothing to do with core legal reasons in the way we've been talking about them, but have to do with core discretionary reasons, like they don't think enforcement priorities and resources ought to be expended in this area. That's all they wanted. That's all they're resting their decision on. Is it possible under the way the commission's procedures now operate for the three controlling commissioners to write a statement of reasons that's only about what we would call core discretionary considerations, and they just don't engage in the law at all, even if the three commissioners who want to go forward think there's a reason to believe and there's a legal violation and it ought to be investigated to the ends of the earth? If three other commissioners think, no, I'm not even focused on the law, I'm only focused on non-core legal considerations, I'm focused on core discretionary considerations, and that's the reason I don't want to go forward, can that be what the sum and substance of the statement of reasons is?
It can be. And sometimes you'll see that not just in split vote dismissals. You'll see that in a 5-0 or 6-0, or depending on the makeup of the commission, that will, despite perhaps even what the general counsel has laid out in the general counsel brief, as recommended to the commissioners, that they have nonetheless,
factors. So if that happens and we get a case in which the only statement of reasons we have by the, what we call the controlling commissioners, is only prosecutorial discretion, core prosecutorial discretion grounds, then that's all we have before us as the reason that the agency didn't go forward.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think in that scenario, the court is left without any, there's nothing in FECA that sets forth how a court should review those enforcement priorities.
But in other contexts, like if someone files a petition asking an agency to conduct the rulemaking and the agency declines, we review that, but it's very deferential review. We basically say, when the agency decided not to move forward with the rulemaking, was their explanation reasonable? Was it adequately explained? And is it, not contradicted by the record? And as long as it's kind of treated very deferentially, and as long as it meets those three metrics, we uphold the agency. That's the law that we apply, even, in a kind of abuse of discretion realm or a decision like that. Why shouldn't we apply that same type of a law to what you would call a prosecutorial discretion decision by the commission in this context?
Because, Your Honor, I think that headbutts against Heckler and the presumption of unreviewability.
It's a presumption, though. But if we say that the presumption is overcome, then why isn't what I just described the way that we would review that prosecutorial, that exercise of prosecutorial discretion? Is it reasonable? Is it adequately explained? Is it not contradicted by the record?
Right. And that is a very deferential level of review. And I recognize that. I think that what the Commission on Hope and New Models cases were attempting to say is that because FECA does not set forth the requirements of how the commission can exercise these priorities, it only rests on this contrary to law finding. So even taking into account those additional factors that you mentioned, whether or not it's reasonable, that still runs counter to the presumption provided under Heckler.
Don't we already know that the Heckler standard, at least the Heckler presumption, is already overcome, at least to some extent, because part of prosecutorial discretion under Heckler, and I'm just reading from Heckler, is whether the agency is likely to succeed if it acts. And that has to be taken into account the likelihood that the legal theory is correct. And so an agency can exercise prosecutorial discretion by having a view of the law and deciding not to go forward based on a view of the law. But everybody agrees, I think, I don't think you dispute the proposition that if the exercise of prosecutorial discretion is based on a conclusion of law and that's set forth, that can be reviewed as contrary to law. Even though it's an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, it can be reviewed as contrary to law under this statute. Isn't that right?
I think what the court has made clear is that you cannot pluck out legal decisions that are closely intertwined with these prosecutorial discretion decisions. What is reviewed?
No, what I'm saying is, suppose you have a situation in which the agency just says, and it's all six of them, all six commissioners. And they just say, I don't want to go forward in this case because my view of the law is that the theory that the general counsel has put forward is just wrong as a matter of law. And therefore, I'm going to exercise my powers of control discretion not to go forward. I'm reading Heckler, and I think that is that in any other context would be considered an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, I believe. And but we know under this statute that that's reviewable, even though it's enveloped by language about an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, because it's predicated on a determination about the legal merits of the theory, it's reviewable as contrary to law.
Right. So what I think has to happen is that it's explicit that the commission has exercised prosecutorial discretion. And second, to your point, Your Honor, that they have set forth those factors that are outlined in Heckler. I think that needs to be clear.
But one of the factors that's outlined in Heckler is a conclusion about law. And we know that that's not enough to insulate it from review because it can be the exercise. I'll call it an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. But if it's grounded in a legal predicate, and that's the only reason for the exercise of prosecutorial discretion, the whole point of the statute is that that can be reviewed, even though it's called prosecutorial discretion. It can be reviewed as contrary to law because the reason for not going forward, the prosecutorial discretion for not reason for not going forward is entirely premised on a legal error.
I think if there is a line to be drawn, there is one in which there's a scenario that's based entirely on the law and just the words there are prosecutorial discretion. However, I want to just hesitate a little bit there because I don't want to go down the path of those statements that include interwoven legal analysis, litigation risk, weighing of the evidence. Those are classic prosecutorial discretion factors that are still somehow based in the law, but yet that remains unreviewable as a matter of prosecutorial discretion.
No, but I suppose the theory is, I think this legal theory that the general counsel is putting forward is erroneous. And therefore, I don't want to expend my resources on pursuing this theory. Mm-hmm. Is that reviewable for as contrary to law?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, because I don't think it has to be the only conclusion.
Isn't it every single time a prosecutor says, I disagree, every single time the agency would say, I disagree with the general counsel's theory of the law, and therefore, as an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, we're not moving forward. That's reviewable. I think you even said that's reviewable.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then if they just tack on, therefore, I don't want to expend my resources on reviewing this. It's saying exactly the same thing. Of course, saying we don't want to go forward is the same thing as saying we don't want to expend our resources on it. We haven't added anything, but it somehow magically renders it unreviewable.
What I think this court should look to in making that determination of reviewability versus unreviewability is still what is set forth in Heckler. So in those statements, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the weighing of the evidence and all of those things, the agency resources are best suited spent on this violation or another. And so if it's outlining some of those Heckler factors, I think that that remains in the category of unreviewability.
So let's suppose the controlling commissioners, or let's say it's, make it even easier, all six commissioners say, the Supreme Court found that, you know, these particular acts violate campaign finance laws, but we think that the Supreme Court got it wrong. And so we're not going to expend our resources going forward with such a case. And, you know, we think that, you know, the weight of the evidence is weak, et cetera, et cetera. Non-reviewable?
I think these are classic decisions that are part of prosecutorial discretion, weighing those different legal reasonings as part of other factors that go into the commission's priorities. And I think I would point back to this court's precedent holding that it doesn't have to be the decision that this court would have come to. It just has to be a reasonable one. And so I think taking
the commissioners could say, we decline to follow the Supreme Court's interpretation of the statute because we know better. And based on that, we are exercising our discretion to not move forward. And that is not contrary to law. That's not reviewable. That's Heckler v. Cheney.
What I think that scenario poses is one of abdication. And I think that that is a separate category of cases that still remain reviewable. If this, if the commission categorically refuses to enforce a particular claim or set of claims based on an erroneous interpretation of the law, but it has to be an explicit policy to create abdication. But your hypothetical, Your Honor, I think would kind of toe that line potentially.
What about the fact that it's black letter kind of settled law in the Supreme Court, our circuit, pretty much every court, that one species of abuse of discretion is if the decision maker, whether it's an agency or a lower court, in making a discretionary call, it relied upon an erroneous legal consideration, that that's per se an abuse of discretion. Coons v. U.S. is a Supreme Court case, and there's lots of others, and from our court, the same. So if one species of abuse of discretion is reviewing for whether discretion is infected with a legal error, then doesn't that mean that contrary to law has to include some form of abuse of discretion review, because abuse of discretion is customarily understood to include correcting legal errors?
I think that is correct. I would agree with you on that, Your Honor. If the statements at issue rested on those erroneous legal grounds, the abuse of discretion standard would apply. If in your hypothetical, you're suggesting that what's not present are those factors that are set forth in Heckler, then I do think that that would be in the category of reviewability, because that would be potentially a contrary to law finding.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, once the camel's nose is under the tent, so to speak, with abuse of discretion being part of what contrary to law means, then in four penny and four pound, you review all of it, but maybe you review all of it very deferentially. Like I said, is it reasonable? Is it adequately explained? Is it not otherwise contradicted by the record? And we move on.
Right. So I do think that that was the universe of reviewability previous to Commission on Hope. There was some level of reviewability. I'll recognize that. And so, however, as you articulated, it remained very deferential. And so the sea change, so to speak, and if there was one, was not really one of the outcome, because the outcome, I think, would still remain the same.
I have a question about because your position seems to turn on the nature of the reasoning. And under Orlowski, I think it's all legal reasoning. But let's say there's statutory reasoning and then there's prudential reasoning. And I take you to be saying that prudential reasoning turns off the reviewability that the statute provides in 30109A8A. And I understand you're following us. You're defending something that we invented. What are the reasons that amount to what people have been referring to as prosecutorial discretion? What is that category of reasons?
To make sure I'm understanding your correction, there are certainly policy reasons. If I can articulate some of those, namely that the commission should be in charge of exercising and setting its own priorities. What Congress did not create was a statute such that private litigants would be setting the commission's priorities. And moreover, that the Congress did not fear inaction by the commission. In other words, creating the commission as such, creating this bipartisan nature of it,
so was there the reasons that, I mean, it's really important under the way you're viewing the statute. It determines whether something's reviewable or not. Is it enough just to say, and in the exercise of our prosecutorial discretion, that's it, end of story, no inquiry?
I don't. And I don't think that's what New Models or Commission on Hope held. What I think those cases made clear is that it wasn't just the magic words. What needed to be present was some understanding that there was prosecutorial discretion based on the factors set forth in Heckler.
So those are agency priorities and the three members get to set them? I mean, what if in the chief judge's type A, type B cases, the three commissioners say we want to prioritize type A cases and not type B cases. But there was a policy statement on the books promulgated by a majority or all of the commissioners that said type B cases shall be prioritized. Then presumably that has to be the assertion that in our discretion, it is our policy to deprioritize the very type of cases that the commission, qua commission, has said we prioritize. Presumably that can't be a kind of reasoning that renders the decision unreviewable. I assume you would agree with that.
I think I would agree with that because perhaps that would fall into the category of potential abdication. I do recognize that abdication can't not be inferred necessarily from ineffective enforcement. It has to be an explicit policy. But if there is one, then that could be something that this court should be able to review.
This scenario, if you have a situation in which, let's suppose we agree with you, just for purpose of this question, that there are core discretionary grounds that are either unreviewable or reviewed with extraordinary deference. I'm not sure there's a huge practical distinction between them, but let's just suppose that that challenge is going to fail. And those are set forward in the statement of reasons. And let's just say it's, can you have a statement of reasons where it's a majority of the commissioners?
You can, yes,
okay,
Your Honor.
So let's say it's a majority. Let's say it's
potentially. The way that the statements, I'm sorry to interrupt, the way that the statements usually take place is because there has been a split vote and there necessitates a statement of reasons. There could be a factual and legal analysis.
Right.
There could be other documents as
well. I'm just trying to take it outside of the three deadlock situations. So let's say it's a majority or even uniformity. But these are the reasons. They're set forth and part of it is enforcement priorities, kind of core discretionary considerations that would in a normal Heckler case would be unreviewable. And then part of it is a legal disquisition that everybody, I think even you would agree, would be reviewable were it the only rationale that was set forward. And suppose that the statement of reason says, we honestly don't know if based on the discretionary considerations alone, we'd not go forward. We just don't know, but it's affecting us. We do take those into account. And then we also have these legal reasons, and the legal reasons turn out to be wrong. Is that statement of reasons subject to review for contrary to law, even though it includes discretionary considerations where the commissioners who sign on to it specifically say, we don't know whether those standing alone would be enough to keep us from going forward?
I think as long as they are present, that is sufficient. The one qualifier sufficient to preclude reviewability. The one
even if they say affirmatively, mm-hmm. we actually don't know that these alone would prevent us from going forward. We don't have to worry about that because we also have these legal reasons.
Right. So certainly the legal reasons would remain reviewable, and the court could. Let me put it this way: if there's a separate claim or count in the administrative complaint, the one that's based on legal reasoning, that could be reviewable. If I'm taking your hypothetical,
it's all the same count.
It's all the same count.
Yeah.
And the Heckler factors are set forth, but it's unclear if they would rely on them.
Yeah.
That potentially might remove it from Heckler if it's not clear that the commission is actually exercising prosecutorial discretion. That's the kind
then,
of clarity
then it
that I'm
then it
hoping
seems
to make.
If that's true, then it seems to me that even your position ultimately varies based on how clear it is that the, by hypothesis, unreviewable or reviewable for extreme deference under an extremely deferential standard, how clear it is that those would independently lead the controlling commissioners not to go forward. And if it's not clear that those independently wouldn't lead the controlling commissioners not to go forward, then the legal reasons can be reviewed.
I don't review it as necessarily an either or, and a fully independent, because I think even in the New Models case, it wasn't entirely clear that it was just this independent ground because it relied on the pages of legal analysis.
Right, and we're just trying to decide whether that's what we're going to do as an on-bank court.
Right.
And I guess I'm it sounds to me, though, that you're at least allowing the possibility that you have to take a look to see how clear is it that the core discretionary grounds that are set forth would, in fact, lead the controlling commissioners, and we can even assume it's unanimous, not to go forward. And if we don't know that that would lead them not to go forward, then we can review the legal part.
What I think should be clear from the statements is that the commissioners, you know, show their work, so to speak, such that it's clear that they exercise prosecutorial discretion. If, I mean, and I'm not basing that on the amount of words necessarily on how much is included, but that when your court is taking a look at the statement, that it's clear under Heckler that they're exercising prosecutorial discretion. And I think that's what the New Models case held, and that was clear under New Models and Commission on Hope in this case as well.
I'm trying to understand how you think we're supposed to read Heckler. Are you saying that under Heckler, prosecutorial discretion is never reviewable?
There is a presumption of unreviewability. That presumption is overcome if the statute outlines those enforcement criteria, and that's not present in FECA. So I would, my position is that that presumption still remains valid because Congress did not explicitly.
The Supreme Court said the presumption in Heckler was overcome in this statute. They were wrong.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The Supreme Court said in terms, the Heckler presumption is overcome under this statute, the FECA statute. That was wrong?
Well, I believe your point to Aikens, Your Honor. And I don't read Aikens as suggesting that all commission decisions are reviewable.
I ask you, you just said you didn't think the presumption was overcome under this statute. And the Supreme Court said in terms, right in Aikens, that the presumption's overcome. Heckler presumption is overcome by FECA.
Correct. When decisions are contrary to law for that one limited position,
the decisions to dismiss. That's what's normally always some sort of form of prosecutorial discretion. But the decision to dismiss is reviewable. Where in Aikens do they say it depends on the factors they relied on?
Well, what I think Aikens said.
Can you turn to Aikens and tell me where you're? Because I just must have misread something.
So I agree, Your Honor, that Aikens rejected the commission's argument that all commission dismissals not to undertake enforcement actions were unreviewable under Cheney because FECA explicitly stated the other.
Because the presumption is overcome.
Correct. Okay. However, I think Aikens.
By the statute.
Yes,
Your Honor. By three commissioners.
Three
commissioners.
Right. And what I think Aikens went on to emphasize, though, is that it depended on a legal ground of the decision. And that's where
what's reviewable under the statute, under 30109A8A, is an order of the commission dismissing a complaint. That's subject to judicial review. And so what provision of the statute carves out from that some orders of the commission dismissing a complaint if the reasons are different?
That's where I think the DCCC, the court's holdings in DCCC come into play, because it was the commission's position prior to that case that these statements were not required because they were unreviewable. Of course, that was rejected by this court. But what the DCCC case held is that we then look to these statements, and in particular, those commissioners that voted against enforcement to determine why the commission acted as it did. So it's FECA, but it's also the DCCC case and this court's precedent that I think that harmonized those reasonings there.
I have a question about the premise that the reason to believe determination can include prudential factors. I believe you answered in response to a question by one of my colleagues that the reason to believe statement could rely solely on prudential factors. And I'm wondering how that squares with the statutory language, which says if the commission determines by an affirmative vote of four of its members that it has reason to believe that a person has committed or is about to commit a violation of this act, then it has to do a bunch of things, including start an investigation. I'm just wondering where in the statutory provision does it allow a statement of reasons to be based solely on prudential factors?
If, Your Honor, that vote on reason to believe fails because the commission has decided not to find reason to believe based on those discretionary factors. The statute doesn't outline that, and it doesn't speak to those discretionary factors.
That's not finding reason to believe. That's deciding not to prosecute on other things. And I believe your friend on the other side said, if they just want to dismiss, they can just not even reach the reason to believe stage. They can just vote to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion. But once you're in the land of reason to believe, you have to make a determination that there's reason to believe that a violation has been committed. And you think it's okay to say, we're not going to make that determination. Instead, we're going to dismiss based on prosecutorial discretion?
No, Your Honor, I think that determination still has to be made, and it's made by that vote. And that vote matters for purposes of reviewability, obviously. But that vote to find not reason to believe can be based on those prudential considerations. So it's still the vote on reason to believe that's taking
place.
But
you're agreeing that they must say something about whether there's a reason to believe a violation has been committed. They could add on things like prosecutorial discretion.
There must be a vote on reason to believe. Yes, Your Honor.
But they don't have to talk about the law.
They do not, Your Honor. Right. There can be a vote on reason to believe, and then they can base that decision on the enforcement criteria.
So that's my question, though. How is it a determination that the crime has or has not been committed, or the offense has or has not been committed, if they don't talk about the offense?
Just that they have decided not to find reason to believe based on those factors. I think that it can be based on the law or...
Logically, is that a reason not to find a reason to believe offense has been committed? I mean, you could decide, I don't want to enforce because of prosecutorial discretion, but is that a reason why, based on the facts and the law, offense hasn't been committed? Is that logically congruent?
It's those commissioners' determination that they have decided not to find reason to believe based on that explanation.
So they've decided not to make the determination that the statute says they're supposed to determine?
At that stage, they can vote whether to find reason to believe or not, and they have proceeded to find not to find reason to believe based on those additional considerations.
Are there any general situations where the commission has followed that actions in terms of just allowing prosecutorial discretion to be its initial finding without getting to a legal reason to believe or not?
So if I'm understanding your question, Your Honor, prosecutorial discretion does take place at other parts of an administrative complaint process.
Initially, we had a lot of questions about would that be a finding initially, just to say that under my prosecutorial discretion, I believe for policy reasons, we're not going to do this or that, or because of resources, we're not going to evaluate these certain priorities. Have you all exercised that practice generally?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, by a majority of commissioners, commissioners on either side of the political party have as well.
Ms. Ward, can I just ask you, I mean, after a 45 committee, the commission can deadlock on a reason to believe vote and then not vote on dismissal. And then there's nothing to review. Is that correct?
What happens then is that the file essentially kind of remains open. And I think that's what 45 committee was saying.
So it just remains open, but then there's no judicial review and there doesn't have to be a statement of reasons.
Yes, except for
it's just unreviewable because having taken the vote, there's no failure to act. And if there's no dismissal, you can only have judicial review of either a dismissal or a failure to act. So in a case where they deadlock on the reason to believe, there's no judicial review, irrespective of reasons.
Except for the DCCC case, that's my one hesitation that requires those statements, but I agree with your Honor's perspective on that.
The statute says we can review a dismissal.
That's
so
right.
Where there's only been a reason to believe vote and no vote on dismissal, there's nothing for us to review. Is that correct? So a lot of talk from ECU about the judicial kill switch that they like to say. I mean, under 45 committee, for there to be no judicial review, there simply has to be a deadlocked vote and no dismissal.
I think that's right under 45 committee, Your Honor.
So I'm
slightly hesitating just because I do consider the holdings in DCCC that required those statements for the court to understand why the commission acted as
well. There's also 45 committee itself, which I've read. And the 45 committee doesn't talk about whether there can be a subsequent failure to act. It only deals with the failure to act that was alleged. It doesn't necessarily mean, it has to subject to interpretation, but I don't think it treats with whether there can never ever be another, a subsequent failure to act challenge if the commission just doesn't do anything?
There potentially could be, Your Honor.
Okay. So there could be. I mean, I just...
That's not how I read that opinion.
Sure. I know we've kept you up here for a long time, but I have a question about the tools available to the commission to manage its docket. And I wonder if there's a practice, for example, of the general counsel collecting a bunch of complaints that for whatever reason that person thinks are just not, you know, not meritorious, and proposes them for vote, like, let's just dismiss these, exercise of prosecutorial discretion, meritless, frivolous, what have you. Is that a process? It seems like many legal institutions would have that kind of process. And I wonder if that's, I mean, you did say that you can, there can be a vote to dismiss before a reason to believe vote. And I'm just asking as a practical matter, is that batched ever? And
I'm not aware of it being batched, so to speak. I think there is a set of neutral criteria that the commission can consider at the front end to determine whether or not it merits moving forward to the next stage of the administrative review process. But I'm not aware of a batching, so to speak.
And are those neutral criteria published in the regulations or in the guidance?
I'm not aware of that. I think when a dismissal takes place at the enforcement, at the early stage provided by the enforcement priority system, that's what it's called. What the claimant receives is a response back that sets forth why the commission did vote to dismiss it at that stage. So that is available as well.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from interveners now. Ms. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Erin Murphy on behalf of the intervener, New Republic. So I absolutely want to talk about the merits and some issues about the text of the statute and the DCCC case in particular. But since we are the party that raised standing here, I thought I should probably start with just spending a few minutes on standing and why we don't think that ECU has established it here. The principal theory here is a theory of informational standing. And I think the problem is this case is just much closer, if you think about it as a spectrum, much closer to this court's Wertheimer case than to the case dealing with coordination with Hillary Clinton's campaign, in that here we have a PAC that disclosed all of its contributions and all of its expenditures. They have all of that information. That's the information that was the basis for the complaint they filed, was looking at that and saying, hey, we see how much money you spent on this campaign, and we see who you got money from. And the information they want is to know whether those were coordinated contributions and therefore soft money contributions on the front end. So that puts this really more in that bucket of the information they want is the information about whether information they already have, factual information they already have, was correctly legally classified. Under this court's precedent, this court has said, if what you just want to know is, you know, whether someone committed a violation of law in the way that they reported information that you already have, that's not sufficient for Article III standing. The other concern that we have is the concern that, you know, TransUnion has now made clear that it's not enough to just say you didn't get information. There has to be a downstream effect, is how TransUnion talks about it. And I'm still a little unclear as to what exactly their downstream effect theory is here. It seems to just be, if we have this information, we can tell people there was a campaign finance violation.
FOIA plaintiffs under TransUnion have to have a downstream effect?
In the discussion of informational injury in TransUnion, when they talk about how it wasn't enough, that the allegation there was, we got the information, but not in the format that Congress required. And the court said, that's not enough. For one, you got the information.
Not my question. Do FOIA plaintiffs in FOIA cases...
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said where in TransUnion. I misheard you.
I apologize. I wasn't articulate enough. Do FOIA plaintiffs have to now show a downstream effect?
I think that's right under TransUnion. That's how I read it. It's an Article III requirement. It's an Article III decision.
That's quite a sea change in the law. I thought the court... I didn't read TransUnion as...
I think in the classic FOIA case where you're seeking factual information that's in, you know, that you don't have, which is obviously different from the facts here and the facts in TransUnion, it's going to be easier in some of those cases. It's going to be easier to talk about how it impacts your programmatic activities.
Okay. So you read TransUnion as overruling all the cases that have allowed, they were all issued without legal authority.
I don't
say that FOIA is a right to have information about what your government's up to.
I don't think it's overruling them. I think it's simply saying that you're
all wrongly decided. Because we didn't.
No, I don't think it's even saying.
Article 3 has been around a really long time. If we didn't have the legal authority, we didn't have the legal authority.
I don't think it's saying all the FOIA cases are wrong. And it's not my argument that all the FOIA cases are wrong. It's that you do have to ask that question in the FOIA cases. And it may be that the answer in many FOIA cases is going to be yes, because you can demonstrate that there's a reason you need the information and something you would do with it.
It's never been required of a FOIA plaintiff to say why they.
I think it's actually, you've always been, you know, had to say something. I mean, the part of it is the idea that Congress has created.
I have a statutory right to information.
And typically.
And asked for it and I didn't get it.
And I think the way the court has processed that differently and when they distinguished some of those cases in TransUnion is at least in that context, you're asking for information that you do not have. And that's in the possession of the government.
So then your case really turns on whether they have it or not. And what they say is we have this undifferentiated blob of information when in fact the statute, the information that we're entitled to is a breakdown of this.
The problem is
though, and that's very different because we can't have that breakdown information in this context is critical. It has legal consequence. It has informational value about how the electoral funding scheme is working for those who wish to lobby about that issue, who wish to inform voters about that issue, and simply releasing the blob of information. I don't mean to be disparaging, but sort of this lump of information that lacks a statutorily required identification of what came when. They don't have what the statute requires.
To the extent they are saying they have only an aggregated blob of information, that's just factually wrong. You can go look yourself. I did it yesterday on the FEC's website. Every expenditure, this is what's different from the Correct the Record case. Because in the Correct the Record case, there was just an overhead. We spent $10 million. And if you go look there today, you will see it says we spent $10 million. It's not broken down because the committee there didn't believe that it needed to provide contributions and expenditures and coordinated contributions. Here, they all were reported as independent expenditures. It's not a blob of information. That's why they were very careful today. The only thing that they can claim is a blob of information is the small amount of money that's an overhead cost, which is basically, you know, not what they're complaining about, because what they're saying were the coordinated contributions are the many line items that they already have that say we spent X amount of dollars on the Rick Scott campaign for this ad. They have all of those dollar amounts. They just want to know whether those dollar amounts were coordinated contributions or independent expenditures. So I do think that puts this on the wrong side of informational injury and much closer to the Sports Wertheimer case.
Ms. Murphy, so I take your point that the logic of TransUnion, you know, raises questions about informational standing here. But in TransUnion, the court seems to specifically put Aikens to one side. So I'm wondering how you understand that for this court.
Yeah, because Aikens is your classic committee case where they're saying we think an organization is a committee that needs to share information that's in the organization's possession, factual information. So they did not know who the contributors were, and they wanted to know who is funding this organization. And the committee's, AIPAC's position was, we don't have to share that because we're not a committee. So in your typical case involving a committee, you know, I don't think it's going to be that hard to get past that, at least the kind of question of whether you have an informational injury at all, because that's information you do not have, factual information. So the consequence of the legal holding that an entity is a committee will be that you're entitled to information that's not presently in the factual record. And that's how the court specifically distinguished Aikens in saying what was different in TransUnion was more like this case because they had the information and were just complaining that it hadn't been given to them in the correct format.
Do you think that Aikens' analysis of standing under FECA for voters applies to organizations or associations like ECU?
Certainly not in the competitive injury way that they're trying to assert here. The kind of competitive injury that's been recognized, one, has always been kind of in the context of candidates, not even voters. Two, has to do with like a legal environmental impediment to competition, that you've got a rule, something about the way the law works that's putting you at a disadvantage. So I really don't think you can take those principles and apply them in that competitive context. In the informational context,
We're not here to suggest that committees have no ability to show Article III standing for purposes of FECA's provisions, but I do think that you have to look at the standing question in light not just of the Supreme Court's guidance in TransUnion, but in light of some of their recent cases, talking about how we think about associational standing, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case, all of that that talks about, hey, we need to be a little bit careful when it comes to committees about thinking about, you know, organizational plaintiffs and making sure that we're holding them, you know, really, really holding them to the same standards that we hold other parties to. If I may turn to the merits, so there's a few things I just want to emphasize at the outset about the text here. One, there's been a lot of discussion today about kind of reviewing the reason to believe vote, but I do think it's quite clear, important to recall that what the court is authorized to review under FECA is not reason to believe votes, it's dismissals. And so there may be a reason to believe vote that is the reason that there was a dismissal, but there may not be, and there doesn't have to be. And we know that because subsection A1 of the statute explicitly contemplates that you can, that the FEC can dismiss a complaint without ever having taken a vote on reason to believe. It says that that's the one kind of vote you can take, a vote to dismiss without ever letting the party, the target of the complaint, respond. So we know that the commission does not have some freestanding obligation to make a determination about reason to believe. They are free to decide to not proceed with a case on grounds other than the conclusion that there's not reason to believe, and they've long done so. And I do think that's a critical distinction because, you know, it just often gets a little bit conflated in the sense of, well, we have to be able to know what they think about reasons to believe. With all due respect, the court doesn't have to know that. They don't have to answer that question. And to the extent it's being suggested that DCCC requires the commission or members of the commission to tell you what they think about the merits, I don't think that's the right reading of it. And if it did say that, I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons I'm not convinced DCCC is compatible with the statute, and I'm happy to talk about those. But certainly to the extent it compels commissioners to offer their views on the merits, I don't think that's something that this court could be requiring them to do consistent with the text of the statute.
Because I fully agree that they don't have to enforce, they could just take a vote on dismissal. But if they do undertake to make a reason to believe finding, doesn't that somewhat cabin what they can do in the context of a reason to believe? Because doesn't the statute say they have to determine that whether there's a reason to believe that a person has committed or is about to commit a violation?
The statute does not say that. The statute says they have to proceed if they determine that there is a reason to believe, if four of them determine that there's a reason to believe. It never says that they have to make a determination about whether there's a reason to believe. So if
I guess my question is, if they can just dismiss for prosecutorial discretion reasons, why do they even get into this reason to believe construct? Because once they're there, it does seem that there is a statutory provision that says, if you determine this, you have to proceed. But if you just want to dismiss it for prosecutorial discretion, you don't have to enter this world, right?
Sure, absolutely. But I don't think the fact that you can do that at the threshold means you can never do it again. You know, as some of the questioning today has discussed, it may be that you're not quite convinced just by a pure reading of the complaint that it's not a great use of resources. You want to hear what the target of the complaint has to say in their response. You want to get some more of that. You want to do all of that. And maybe in the meantime,
So is there ever a scenario where you could have a reason to believe determination that's based solely on prosecutorial discretion?
I think you can have a commissioner vote that they are not going to determine that there was reason to believe for a reason that has nothing to do with the merits. I mean, you're being asked, are you making a determination that there's reason to believe? And I don't think there's anything wrong with a commissioner saying, I'm not going to make that determination because I don't think this is the best use of the commission's resources, whatever your kind of classic prosecutorial discretion explanation may be. I think that's entirely compatible. You know, I mean, I suspect if this court said you can't do that in that context, then the commission would probably shift to, hey, we're going to take dismissal votes first, because otherwise you're precluding us from kind of talking about our real reasons. But that to me is why it seems sort of artificial to say, well, you can say that as long as you're calling it a vote to dismiss, but you suddenly can't say that if, you know, a majority of your colleagues call for a vote on reason to believe, all of a sudden those things are off limits. So I think it's perfectly appropriate for commissioners, including a majority of the commission, to say we're not going to make a determination that there's reason to believe for reasons that are not based on the merits but are instead based on prosecutorial discretion.
Doesn't that counsel towards viewing the statute that everything is reviewable, but obviously everything isn't reviewable in the same way? If you are reviewing whether they're exercising their discretion or making a decision based on a legal assessment, then that gets no deference. But if they are exercising their discretion based on what we would call kind of prosecutorial discretion reasons, that gets a lot of deference, but it's still reviewable. But rather than trying to figure out how to, you know, take some of the vegetables out of the soup, you just review the whole soup, you eat the whole thing, right?
Yeah, I respectfully disagree. And because, yeah, this gets to the other textual point that I think got a little lost in some responses today. I heard a point where it was said that FECA authorizes this court to review dismissals full stop. That's not correct. FECA authorizes the court to review dismissals for whether they are contrary to law. And that's a phrase, you know, you could think about this case less as a question of what is a reviewable action, because we don't dispute the act of dismissing is reviewable under FECA. But the question is, what is reviewable as contrary to law? And exercises of enforcement discretion are not contrary to law. You could think they're not reviewable under contrary to law. I'd probably just say they're not contrary to law. I mean, you're exercising your enforcement discretion. So by definition, you're not acting contrary to law. There's, you know, different semantic ways to put it.
Can I ask how far you would take that? So sure. I think this was effectively one of the chief judge's hypotheticals. They say, as a matter of enforcement discretion, we're not finding reason to believe. Our one and only reason is we don't think a legal violation occurred.
Yeah.
And here's our 5 pages of analysis. Do you agree? In that situation, we would review the legal analysis.
I think in that situation, there's room to review it. And here's why I would say that, because
I didn't hear what you said.
That you could review it. And here's how I process that is, I think there's room for a threshold analysis of whether the commission exercised prosecutor enforcement discretion. And if it's plain on the face of the decision that they say, you know, I mean, to me, the classic is kind of like, we've concluded we lack jurisdiction and therefore we will not exercise it as a matter of discretion. I mean, they're using the word discretion, but it seems to me if that's all you're saying, it's plain as day that you haven't actually exercised discretion. So I think you could leave room for, as I think of it, a threshold analysis of whether there has been an exercise of prosecutorial discretion.
So what about, I'm not saying this is exactly what the decision, the statement says in this case, but what if they say, this case is not worth our resources. The one and only reason is the legal claim, the following legal claim, subjective evidence is required. That's not worth our time. Seems like the same result would follow, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to talk about why I don't think that's wrong or what they said here, but I think there's a kind of, this
question
is why,
is if that's what they said.
Yeah, and this is why I think, you know, you quickly get into kind of degrees of, and so to my mind, if you're going to have that threshold inquiry, it should be a very narrow one that places the thumb on the scale of, if they say they're exercising prosecutorial discretion, by and large, we take them at their word. And we need them to have explicitly kind of like articulated the concept of prosecutorial discretion wrong. I think there's also room under there for, if you say in my exercise of discretion, I refuse to enforce the law on a constitutionally impermissible basis. You know, I think you could then say I think there's room to treat that as that's not what we would think of as an exercise of discretion. What I don't think there's room for is the kind of analysis of, well, you know, you said prosecutorial discretion, but you spent like 3 sentences on that and 6 pages on the law. So we think it had more, it mattered more to you, the law, than the prosecutorial discretion.
I'm not quite sure I understand why saying that it's grounded in the law makes it something other than an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. It just, I mean, Heckler just says whether the agency is likely to succeed if it acts.
So
why isn't a legal analysis part of an exercise of prosecutorial discretion?
I think this, to me, this is what I take Heckler footnote 4 to be getting at, is the distinction between when they say maybe this case would be different if it had been based solely on a conclusion, you know, there obviously there was a jurisdictional conclusion and enforcement discretion. And I take their point in the first sentence footnote 4 to be, if all they said is we don't have jurisdiction, you know, I appreciate that you could view that as itself an exercise of discretion, which is why I think it's preserved in a footnote rather than answered outright. But they do recognize that that could be different. That could be different because even though in a sense it is, you know, it is still an exercise of discretion. Maybe it's different if your exercise of discretion is 100% based on the law. But I don't think that's the same thing as what Heckler's talking about in the text, which is when an agency takes into account likelihood of success. That is distinct from saying we've concluded there is no violation or we have no jurisdiction. It's a completely different thing when an agency says, look, like, you know, we may think we're right, but we think we're probably going to lose. We've got a bad forum. We might have a good forum, but we think we could get reversed by the Supreme Court. And that would be really bad for all our enforcement priorities. Or even, you know, we think we've got a pretty good case here, but boy, it's going to be hard to prove. Or we don't think we have a great case here. And given the resources, that all balances out wrong. So I don't think the fact that you're talking about likelihood of success can do anything to eliminate the rule that you're not able to review that as an exercise of enforcement discretion. I'm only leaving room for like what I view as a pretty narrow universe where the agency explicitly says the only reason we're exercising enforcement discretion is because we've concluded there is no legal violation or we have no jurisdiction. And I mean, I'm happy to say you can't even review that, but I'm also comfortable if the court wants to be leaving, you know, room for that Heckler footnote 4 universe of cases.
But I'm trying to understand your view of Heckler and how that works here. So you're saying that the presumption against reviewability of non-enforcement has not been rebutted, or it's only rebutted if certain things are said, or I'm trying to make sure I understand legally
sure
how you are framing this.
Sure. I think there's sort of in my mind two distinct questions. So to the, you know, the aspect of Heckler that says declining to take an enforcement action at all, that's rebutted by FECA because FECA allows you to review dismissals. So we are, you know, we're not here arguing, you know, setting aside any constitutional questions about that as a statutory matter. We acknowledge that FECA says you can review dismissals. So it rebuts Heckler to that extent of saying that you can't review the dismissal or the, you know, the declining to proceed, period. But Heckler then articulates the reasons that you can't traditionally review enforcement discretion. And it talks about the reason that you wanted the core reason you can't do that. I mean, one is it's executive prerogative, but when it talks about how Congress could rebut it, it explains the way Congress would rebut that presumption that you can't review the exercise of enforcement discretion is by constraining the agency's enforcement discretion. And Congress has not done that in FECA. There is no provision of FECA that says you have to go forward with these types of actions. You have to prioritize this over that. You must spend X amount of money a year pursuing enforcement actions. You know, nothing like that. There is nothing in this statute that constrains enforcement discretion at all. And that means there are no tools available to this court to decide that the exercise of enforcement discretion is itself contrary to law.
Not even reasonable, adequately explained, not otherwise contradicted by the record.
That is not part of any traditional notion of reviews of exercises of enforcement discretion. Those are, I will grant you, traditional tools for reviewing exercises of action that agencies take. But there's no tradition of reviewing an agency's decision not to act.
What about that sort of review would implicate or step on separation of powers?
I think it gets into the concern that traditionally the kinds of things Heckler's talking about, resource allocation, prioritizing, enforcement priorities, are the prerogative of Article 2. They are the prerogative of the executive.
Making an agency articulate a reasonable explanation and adequately explaining it and ensuring that what they say isn't a lie, all of that somehow intrudes on the prerogative of the executive?
I think there's a real concern it does, because to what end? What is the reason courts have to force agencies to provide reasoned explanations for determinations that courts have no ability to review?
So asking the executive not to lie to the public, that somehow intrudes upon the executive's prerogative.
I think what you need is, I mean, what Heckler is getting at is, you know, there may be lots of impermissible reasons prosecutors don't bring criminal prosecutions, but we don't typically require a prosecutor to put out a statement of reasons to the public explaining it. their decisions, you know, are subject to public scrutiny, and people can call them out and point out if they think that you're not being fair in enforcement. We have a political process, but we do not typically require agencies, prosecutors, executive branch officials to provide a statement of reasons for why they are declining to move forward with an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, and nothing in FECA requires the agency to do so. There is nothing in FECA that says, you know, to the requirement that kind of says you've got to have all this controlling commissioner stuff. I mean, that all comes from this court's precedent. So, you know, there's, and I'd love to have a discussion about that and about the whole dynamic of the controlling commissioners and all of that. But the notion that, you know, that it's for the Article III courts to kind of call out the Article II branch and require them to provide reasoned explanation seems to me pretty inconsistent with what Heckler's getting at.
But this is based on, I'm trying to follow your argument. This is based on a provision in the statute that says an order of dismissal is subject to judicial review. And there's nothing in the statute that says, but we're committing to agency discretion a certain subset of dismissals. It's dismissals, period. And I understand that the statute was based in part on the LMRDA, which in Dunlop, there wasn't even a private right of action there, but the Supreme Court read Congress to have overridden any Heckler type presumption and say that the reasons, discretion or otherwise, are subject to review.
I think there absolutely is something in the statute that tells you this. It is contrary to law. It does not say you get to review them
for a stop. To get to where you
I don't think you have to, because I disagree with the FEC. We take a different position on Orlovsky, but I also appreciate the distinction that the FEC is drawing between applying arbitrary and capricious review when there's been a determination on the merits as opposed to when there hasn't. But, you know, I don't think it's the best reading of the statute that there's room for that kind of abuse of discretion. To me, contrary to law means contrary to law. But even if you thought there was
Contrary to statute.
It means contrary to
arbitrary and capricious abuse of discretion.
It means you interpreted the law wrong. You got the law wrong, not you had all the law right, but we're going to now look at whether we think you were being particularly reasonable in how you applied it, whether we think you engaged in reasoned analysis. There's a statute that tells you how to do that. It's the APA. Congress had the APA as a model, and it did not use the language.
Contrary to regulations?
I'm sorry?
Regulations?
I will have to say I haven't 100% thought through what my position is on regulations or any different than statutes, but you know, I think there's certainly room for the idea that contrary to regulations could fit within contrary to law, subject to lots of other caveats about regulations and the change of state of administrative law.
So in answer to Judge Phillips, I mean, you think that there could be arbitrary and capricious and abuse of discretion review that qualifies as contrary to law review, but that wouldn't necessarily take you to the step of saying that core exercises of prosecutorial discretion are also reviewable as an abuse of discretion or as arbitrary and capricious.
Yeah, and I could just put just slightly articulate that differently, just to be very clear about our position. We think the better reading is you can't have either.
I get that, but
I think that it is possible to draw a distinction between the two and say you can, you know, I don't think Orlovsky was contemplating abuse of discretion review of exercises of prosecutorial discretion. So if the court, you know, I think you could at least draw a distinction and say, we leave, and you don't really have to get to it in this case. I know it is up before you in this case, but I think it would be coherent for the court to say, you know, we can leave for another day the question of what scope of abuse of discretion review there is when we're reviewing a determination that's on the merits. But that does not encompass, or Orlovsky was never meant to encompass, the kind of review we've been talking about today of reviewing the exercises of enforcement discretion separate and apart from determinations on the merits.
I know a lot of the discussion has talked about prosecutorial discretion as if it is something distinct from the decision whether or not to proceed in a case. I don't see that. I think the decision whether or not to proceed with a case, if you're a criminal prosecutor, it's absolutely something that no court scrutinizes. I mean, except maybe in New York, so then the question is what kinds of reasoning are, you know, in the reason to believe determination, what are reviewable? I mean, if the statute says that the order dismissing is reviewable, it seems like what it is saying is a prosecutorial decision not to go forward and therefore to dismiss is reviewable.
End of story. And we, and you don't, I mean, just as in the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, you don't carve something reviewable out of something Congress has said is unreviewable. So too, you don't carve unreviewability out of something that Congress has said is reviewable, unless Congress somewhere tells you that it's doing that carving out. I'm just not quite following.
And I think where Congress told you they're carving that out is when they said contrary to law. That has to mean something. They said there was a constraint on what this court could review dismissals for. It can review them for whether they are contrary to law. And you take that phrase, you look at it against the body of jurisprudence, statutory law, Heckler, the APA. It doesn't track the language of the APA, and it certainly doesn't in and of itself override the general principle that if there is no articulation by Congress of any constraint on an agency's enforcement discretion, then courts don't have any tools by which you could say that the exercise of enforcement discretion is contrary to law. So that's why I come back to, you know, I mean, it may seem like a minor distinction, but I find it easier to process it as, you know, it's fine if you want to say that a dismissal that's based on enforcement discretion is reviewable. It's a reviewable agency action. It's just that it is by definition, not contrary to law, because there is no legal basis by which you could say the enforcement discretion is illegal.
So how does that avoid the so-called magic words problem? I mean, it used to be that the FEC would explain, here's why we think we shouldn't go forward. There's some statutory reasons, there's some prudential reasons, and the courts would look at that for, you know, deferentially, for, you know, whether the sort of institutional factors are non-arbitrary and the statute, you know, whatever. And every case is different sort of how they interact. But then after CHGO, we have this magic words, like all you need to do is say enforcement discretion. And that does not seem problematic to you, I gather. Like it just a bare, unexplained statement by a non-majority, enforcement discretion cuts off review.
Well, I want to separate out two things there, because I think the question about a non-majority and the reasoning is distinct. So I do want to kind of start with the proposition of assume you just have a majority, so we can set aside for a moment the distinct DCCC concerns. But, you know, if you have a majority of the commission, I mean, they still can and do articulate, you know, they dismiss cases for legal reasoning. I mean, in this very case, there was a count that the controlling commissioners said, as to this count, we just like agree with the general counsel on the merits. We're not exercising discretion. So there's nothing that's standing in the way of the commission continuing to, in cases where they think there's a basis to make a legal determination, making it. And they have been doing that. And I think, you know, the commission probably knows this better than I do, but my understanding is the percentages actually haven't like radically shifted since this court's crew line of cases. So I don't think kind of the hypothetical that the agency is going to act in bad faith.
But I'm asking you a question. I mean, really, the incentives are quite different. If your reasoning is going to be reviewed, or the less you say, the more powerful protection you have against judicial scrutiny. I mean, they may do all kinds of things, and I don't think the legal issue depends on, you know, the degree of total abdication or not. I really am interested in your view whether that is sort of exactly what you would anticipate and bless, that a reason that just says enforcement discretion or even prosecutorial discretion, even though there's no criminal prosecution going on, is just categorically no review.
Sure. And I suppose a lot of this comes as
sure,
a question
yes.
of, oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just saying sure in response. Sure, let me respond to your question, not a yes. So I think a lot of this starts with the lens through which you come at this statute. And if you come at it by thinking, you know, boy, Congress was trying to make sure that everything the agency, the commission does gets reviewable. Like, I get it. Then you start to worry, hey, the commission has a way to kind of get in the way of judicial review. I don't think that's the best way to understand this statute. I think the better way to understand this statute is Congress is providing a safety valve for instances where the commission actually committed clear contrary errors of law, a narrow universe of cases where the commission did something that is objectively legally wrong. It wasn't saying, you know, we need to like ensure that we can get into the mental processes of the commission in every case and understand everything they did, because above all things, we're prioritizing judicial review. I think the statute would have looked quite different if that's what Congress had in mind. And contrary to law, to me, that very narrow phrase that doesn't model other forms of review is saying,
saying this isn't, you know, we're not super concerned about non-enforcement. This statute is designed to make non-enforcement the default. That's why there's a 4-member affirmative vote requirement. That means even in a context when you have 5 commissioners, 4 commissioners who are still a quorum, the minority is supposed to be able to override the majority who wants to go forward with an enforcement action. Indeed, that's actually like the only thing that the 4-member affirmative vote requirement accomplishes in FECA, is to ensure that even when you don't have 6 members and you would otherwise have a majority of commissioners of 3 who want to go forward, the one is supposed to be able to override them. That's the only time the 4-member majority requirement ever even matters. So,
but,
you know,
but it's, I think historically it's not the case that they're saying great if there's no enforcement, awesome, because they created the commission because the Department of Justice wasn't doing anything to enforce campaign finance law.
Sure, but the commission,
so they
was,
wanted it to be functional, and they created a private right of action when they didn't need to. There could have just been judicial review of legal issues, but they're saying, you know, we don't want to be in a position of forcing the commission to do something that it doesn't want to do. They could have not created, in your view, they wouldn't have created a priority.
No, I a couple of responses. First, this is not a citizen suit with an exhaustion requirement. Congress could have created a citizen suit that simply said,
there's
you
a
have to ask the SEC, FEC first. If they don't want to proceed, you get to proceed as long as you have Article 3 standing. This is about as far from that as it gets. There is only a citizen suit if the FEC does 2 things wrong. A court has to find that the FEC acted contrary to law, and then it has to additionally find that the FEC did not conform to a judicial decree saying that it acted contrary to law. So to look at that and say Congress's priority was ensuring that citizens could always enforce the statute if the FEC declined to do so seems to me to be denying the reality of the statute. And that's where I'd step back and recall. I mean, this
to
is,
be fair, I don't think I said that.
I didn't suggest you were saying that. That may be a view I thought I heard articulated a little bit from some of my friends at the podium today. So I don't think it's really fair to think of this as a classic citizen suit provision so much as a safety valve for extreme cases where the commission says we're just not going to do anything with a complaint, or situations where the commission is not moving forward for reasons that are just unambiguously contrary to law.
Do you agree that abuse of discretion review includes at least as one species of when something can be an abuse of discretion, a legal error that was relied upon in exercising discretion?
In the classic context, yes. I mean, I think we're talking generally about abuse of discretion, even not my views about this particular statute. Yes.
Yes. In other words, that contrary to law review could include abuse of discretion, at least in that context, right?
I think in traditional APA review, what the APA talks about is, arbitrary, capricious, abuse of discretion or otherwise not in accordance with law. And we accept that in the context of reviewing agency action, the general rule is, if the agency relied on reasoning that's contrary, it's, unlawful reasoning, then that's a basis to conclude that it fits somewhere within APA basis to vacate. But we're not operating under the APA here. We're operating under a different statute that has a narrower scope of judicial review.
Congress used the words contrary to law, and in trying to figure out what that means.
Sure.
If that has meant at least, for the 50 years preceding the writing of this statute to mean a species of you could call it arbitrary and capricious, or you could call it abuse of discretion review, then why shouldn't that move the needle?
And I think I may have been, I want to be a little more precise in my answer. I mean, because there is a textual difference. The APA treats that as not in accordance with law. And that is not the language that's in this statute. This statute uses the language of contrary to law. To the extent the kind of not in accordance with law, abuse of discretion, arbitrary and capricious conception, kind of all fits into an not in accordance with law conception under Trask classic APA review, I don't think you can necessarily import all those concepts from APA review into a context where Congress used markedly different statutory text than it used in the APA.
So contrary to law means something materially different than not in accordance with law?
I think there's to me, in the context of a statute like this, where we're already operating in an area that is traditionally not subject to judicial review, where you have extreme separation of powers concerns plus First Amendment concerns, I think there's lots of reasons to read contrary to law as meaning something stricter than not in accordance with law.
Ms. Murphy, do you have any historical evidence for that distinction? I mean, because I take your view to be contrary to law means, and you know, following up on Judge Wilkins' question, contrary to law means contrary to positive law, constitution, statute, maybe regulations, but not in accordance with law, you suggest means something else. I mean, do you have any historical reason for believing those terms are distinct?
I don't have any kind of universe of cases, statutes I can point you to that use one version of it versus the other, because, you know, a lot of time you're just operating under APA review. So I will admit I'm reasoning more from text and from context here and from the fact that, you know, I do think that the thumb ought to go on the scale of reading judicial review narrowly in a context where the Supreme Court has indicated it's questionable whether you can have judicial review at all consistent with the constitutional separation of powers. So to me, that's a good reason to say, unless there were like a really clear body of law saying the phrase contrary to law does clearly encompass all these other types of review, that you should probably err on the side of not reading it to incorporate it. But I will also, you know, reiterate my point earlier that to me, this is only a debate about whether you can apply that in the context of reviewing legal merits reasoning, not whether you could ever carry it over to address enforcement discretion determinations.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions. Yeah.
For me, the hard case is when the dismissal order, whether it's controlling commissioners or majority, I don't think matters, but when the dismissal order has legal reasoning and purely discretionary considerations jumbled together.
Yeah.
So help me. I mean, if there is legal reasoning, that's reviewable. So why you said, you know, sort of presume, I think at one point you said presume that the discretionary factors are independently sufficient to support the result. Why would we do that? Why wouldn't the presumption sort of run the other way? If they jumble it all together and don't say each category of reasoning is independently sufficient, we can review the legal piece and send it back.
And to me, you know, if I'm taking the hypothetical right, you're kind of assuming the decision where it's ambiguous, as opposed to the one that's saying clearly, you know, they're distinct,
they just,
or the one that's
both.
Clearly mistakenly kind of saying, for our legal reasons, this is our, but the one where you just kind of like can't tell right. Absolutely clearly. You know, to my mind, I think I'd go back to the basic backdrop rule being prosecutorial discretion in whole or in part. And I think that kind of given the constitutional sensitivities in this context, that it makes sense to, you know, you got to kind of err on one side or the other. And I think in the context of reviewing what are classically traditionally non-reviewable actions, the decision not to go forward, and in the context of a statute that asks whether it's contrary to law, you know, you should be looking for something that tells you that it clearly was contrary to law. In a jumbled case, you can't say it was clearly contrary to law. You can only say, you know, like maybe, but I'm not really sure it was. And so, you know, maybe the right way to process that kind of case is by saying, look, the ultimate burden is to prove to us that it was contrary to law. And if it's ambiguous, like you haven't made that showing. So the tie goes to there was nothing contrary to law here, and the agency was permissibly exercising its prosecutorial.
I mean, another way of thinking about it is the legal reasoning is bad, that is contrary to law, and then the remaining question is whether the discretionary considerations thrown in makes that reasoning harmless or not prejudicial.
It is. I mean, but, you know, I guess I come back to the point of the ultimate question for this court is, was the dismissal itself, you know, was the action of dismissal contrary to law? And I just don't think in a case where it's jumbled together that you can clearly say it was contrary to law. I think the better answer in that context is,
you know, they've articulated enforcement discretion, and that is not contrary to law. And unless and until they kind of tell us they didn't really mean enforcement discretion, they were really doing this all on the basis of law, we're not going to assume that.
And then so, just give me 30 seconds on unpacking this order, which to me seems jumbled.
Yeah.
And there's clearly articulated enforcement discretion. I don't think it's magic words, but there's at least a plausible reading of it where the exercise of enforcement discretion rests on what I take to be a contested legal issue about whether motivation is an essential element of candidacy.
Sure. I think that even if you accepted that permission, there's other aspects of the determination of enforcement discretion that are distinct, talking about the statute of limitations, the backlog. You know, to me, that's enough that you don't get to say, well, you had lots of other good enforcement discretion reasons, but we're afraid like one component of it had something to do. And I would also say, you know, it's really, in that kind of case, I'd at least wanted to be something where it's clearly like, hey, we've interpreted the law and said something like positive about the law that can be reviewed, as opposed to there's some stray mention there that happened to discuss like the law in a way that I'm happy to explain why we don't think is remotely wrong as a matter of the merits. But that aside, you know, to pluck that out when they're talking about, we got a huge resource constraint problem, we got a backlog, we haven't had a forum for a long time, we got a statute of limitations.
Thank you.
But I'm trying to, when it's jumbled together, like this, how do you think that the court should perform its analysis? It should just simply see whether they used words that reflect the exercise of traditional prosecutorial discretion, and as long as they used those words, then we don't review any further. Or do we look at the substance of those words and whether those words make sense, are reasonable, not contradicted by the record? You would say, we don't do any of that. We just look to see whether the presence of those words implicating discretion is apparent. And if so, then we stop.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have the words, you know, to put a little more meat on it, just to be sure we're talking about the same thing. If you've got the words like, we don't think this is the best use of our resources, given that we have a backlog, I do not think this court has the ability to look at that and say, well, we want to know, how many cases do you really have? How much, what resources do you really have? Is that
so
really a fair thing to say? It's not magic words. It's not, that's not magic words. That is the expressed view.
Okay, they're not magic, but they're the sufficient words. They're the right words.
They are the right words, but they are the reasons. I mean, and the agency is operating here under a presumption of regularity that it means what it says. So it's not simply, you know, oh, we found some words, the quote we said we can say, so we'll just drop those in. I mean, you're presuming that they're not lying when they put out a statement of reasons. When they articulate these things, they mean them. If they don't,
the point
is
that we don't, once we find that the words are present, we don't get to review whether they're reasonable, whether the explanation makes sense, whether it's contradicted by any facts.
If the words we're talking about are an articulation of an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, enforcement discretion, this court does not get to look behind that and say, did you exercise your enforcement discretion in a reasonable way?
Just factually, undisputably wrong. They said, we think we should not go forward for enforcement discretion reasons and enforcement discretion reasons only. Two, one, we've got a backlog, and two, this is about someone who's not running for election again. And they are factually wrong. The commission has put out on its public, it's on its website, its letters to Congress, we have zero backlog. And it is a matter of public record that this person is running for office, right? Again, it's a filing, they've announced it, they've got ads going. And no,
I think the backlog piece of it is an independent basis that is not judicially reviewable.
Because even if it's,
and I just think,
even,
you know,
it's completely factually wrong. Both, I gave you two, and they're both completely factually wrong.
Right. And what I'm saying is, you know, the first one's not because none of it is because the second part is not. I don't think there becomes an exception to the tools of the ability to review for cases where you're convinced from information that you have that they didn't exercise their prosecutorial discretion.
We do have an authority to review and we look at reasons and it's fine. That's your position. I just want to make clear that if it is indisputably factually wrong, that doesn't matter.
I don't think it's contrary to law for the commission to say, you know, that we're exercising our prosecutorial discretion. And I just worry that once you've gone
down the path. That's not what I asked you. I said, is it contrary to law to say we are exercising a decision? We would not go forward for two reasons. It's not worth the resources for two reasons. We should conserve our resources for two reasons. One, backlog. There's no backlog. Two, candidate's not running again. Candidate is indisputably running again. And I just, you say that's not legal error.
I think it's generally not reviewable. I will give you the caveat that at a certain point, I do think you run into the Heckler footnote 4 kind of concern about abdication. And if you've got, you know, the
commission. Is that an abdication? But just factually clearly wrong?
What I was going to say is if you had like, you know, the commission say that like 18 times in a row, and it's clear that there's no backlog and they're just saying it over and over and over again.
Okay. But if they, each time they come up with something factually wrong, but they find something different.
I mean, you're kind of positing a world where they're able to say 18 factually wrong things.
I don't know where you get your number 18. I don't know why it suddenly becomes, it's perfectly consistent with the law. It's not contrary to law to be flatly wrong about the facts on which you're depending once, twice. I guess you'd say 17 times, but not 18.
What I'm saying,
what is your principle?
What I'm saying is in Heckler footnote 4, what the court talks about is if you reach the point where the commission, where an agency is abdicating its enforcement duties. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can reach that point based on determination in one case that they said something.
Heckler's an APA case. This is not an APA statute. This is an exception to Heckler. That's what Aiken says. This is a review. So I'm trying to understand. We have to talk about FECA now. So what in FECA tells us?
Sure. And FECA has said that you can review for contrary to law. And I think that you could understand contrary to law to incorporate footnote 4 of Heckler in the sense that if you reached a point where you, this is what I understand footnote 4 of Heckler to be saying, that at a certain point, if you have complete abdication.
Your certain point is?
I think you'd have to be able to demonstrate a pattern that tells you that what is really going on is that the agency is just not admitting that they have adopted a complete policy. Yes, because I think otherwise, you know, you could just have the agency have made a mistake. And what I'm saying is if there's enough of a pattern that you can look at it and say, look, this is really just a cover for the agency actually having abdicated wholesale its enforcement obligations, maybe then you start to get into that abdication dynamic. But I don't think you can get there just because the commission said one thing wrong in one case that you can demonstrate was factually incorrect about their premise for exercising enforcement discretion.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have any more questions at this point.
I have one. You've mentioned constitutional sensibilities a few times, and that might include any number of concerns, presidential appointments, presidential removals, prosecutorial discretion, standing to bring third-party suits, private non-delegation related to that, regulation of core political speech. I guess maybe can you think of any more reasons why the FEC is unconstitutional? And when you say constitutional sensibilities, can you just elaborate on what you mean?
So I'm focused on two in principle here. I mean, certainly lots of other discussions we could have about constitutional issues, and maybe this court will soon be having them about other constitutional concerns with the commission. But the two core ones for me to read, so I think you have to read kind of like the entirety of FECA against the backdrop of the First Amendment, the fact that we're talking about a statute that's explicitly authorizing an agency to operate in regulating core First Amendment activity. This court has said that before. That's been recognized by the Supreme Court. You know, that in and of itself is a reason to be cautious in reading this statute and the scope of what this statute authorizes. And then in the context of this particular case, we're talking about, you know, at the very least unusual, if not unique, statutory provision in that it is authorizing Article III courts to review determinations by, I'm going to, for the sake of argument, say Article II agencies about decisions not to move forward with an enforcement action, which is something that's extremely constitutionally sensitive. The Supreme Court, you know, more recently suggested they're a little unclear on whether they even think Congress can constrain that. And so in a context where you've got that sensitivity from a separation of
powers perspective, I think that's another reason to be very cautious about reading how broadly, you know, how broadly you would look at these provisions. And I would point you back. I mean, you know, it's, I concede it's never like the most helpful thing in the world to be pointing to dissents, but this is the principle that Justice Scalia articulated in his dissent in Aikens when talking about, I would review even the question of who has, is a party aggrieved here, with that all in mind and recalling that we should be a little cautious when dealing with such an unusual statutory provision from separation of powers perspective.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hancock, we'll give you the 5 minutes that you reserve for rebuttal, and I'll ask you to keep it to 5 minutes. You don't have to use the full 5 minutes, unless my colleagues have questions, which case, of course.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Yes, just a couple of points, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have. First, I just wanted to push back on the separation of power suggestion at the end there a little bit. So if I heard correctly, so congressional review of agency action is not a constitutional problem. It's a constitutional problem not to have congressional review of agency action. The FEC's enforcement process, again, is a complaint-driven process that ends in final agency action, dismissal. This is not a situation where you have an individual prosecutor who has made a decision not to indict, and then there is no final agency action articulating that decision. So I think it's just the wrong framing. Review under FECA doesn't ever require the agency to go forward and do anything. If the agency feels like it has resource and priority constraints that prevent it from going forward and enforce the law, it never has to do so, but that creates the exact moment you would want a private right of action to go forward, which is why Congress created it in the first place. FECA is not a law like, say, US v. Texas, where that law like required DHS to go and arrest more people. This is a totally different situation that makes Heckler a poor fit here. Second, about the statement of reasons in this case, I just want to push back a little bit on the sense on the notion that it is completely jumbled between law and discretion. So at Joint Appendix 287 to 289, the statement of reasons contains three pages of legal analysis explaining why the controlling commissioners were, quote unquote, not persuaded by the Office of General Counsel's recommendation to find reason to believe. Three pages of legal analysis before any mention of discretion ever comes up. So they do answer the no reason to believe question in this statement of reasons. And yet under the Crewe cases, it's insulated. As to the statement of law that exists on that last page with the discretionary considerations, the subjective objective distinction between determining whether someone's a candidate is not just a minor technicality. It's extremely important. That goes to the heart of the determination of when someone crosses that threshold and then has to start reporting as a candidate, has to be subject to FECA's requirement, source and limitation requirements. And if that inquiry is mischaracterized as a subjective one, it becomes incredibly harder to prove, and it's going to result in more reporting violations and potentially more candidates taking in soft money not subject to FECA's
Mischaracterized in what way? You think it's objective.
Correct. And the commission does as well, at least a majority supported authority from the commission. Finally, just wanted to push back really quick on the informational standing piece. This case is not like Wertheimer. It's distinguishable from Wertheimer for the exact reasons that the Correct the Record case distinguishes Wertheimer. We do not have the particular values of the in-kind contributions from New Republican to Senator Scott. And New Republican had a broader mission than just its relationship with Senator Scott. Its mission was to support a broader swath of Republican candidates. And indeed, in that same election cycle in 2018, it spent nearly $1 million on a House race in California in the 45th district. And so it's not a fait accompli that all of New Republican spending qualified as in-kind contributions to Scott. We still don't have the disaggregated breakdown of the values. And that is the new information. In addition, part of our informational standing claim is that we also don't have Scott's filings. Scott, when he crossed the candidate threshold, as we allege in mid-2017, would have had to start filing financial reports with the FEC. Those are still not filed. And would have had to file statements of candidacy and organization at that time as well. Those financial reports could reveal information that is not disclosed to this day, such as maybe additional contributors or other expenditures. with that, Your Honor, unless Your Honors have any additional questions, we would respectfully request that Your Honors overturn the crew cases, reverse the district court below, and remand for review of our claims.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take this case under submission.